You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It's my great pleasure to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week James Mark Leese. He is a founding member of the Stop the F-35 Coalition in Burlington, Vermont, which is putting together a broader coalition from places all over the country and the world to oppose the F-35 airplane. James has published some 24 articles on the F-35 and F-35 basing to highlight the F-35 issue statewide. In fact, he ran for the office of Vermont Adjutant General, the leader of the Vermont National Guard in 2013, which is elected by the legislature. James Mark Leese, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
It's a pleasure to be here with you, James.
It's great to have you on. I want to, get into what the F-35 is and what's the matter with it. But first, I'm just curious why you would run for leader of the Vermont National Guard.
Well, Vermont at the time was one state where any citizen could run for that office. And we were trying to encourage the legislature to consider the plan by the Air Force to base F-35 jets here in Vermont. And we invited the Military Affairs Committee of the legislature, of the House, to hold a hearing where all sides could present the facts and arguments. And they refused. So the only way we thought that we could bring this issue to the legislature was by taking advantage of the opportunity to run for Adjutant General. And by doing so, I had the opportunity to speak before all three caucuses. We have three major parties in Vermont. And so I got to speak to the Democratic, Republican, and Progressive caucuses in the legislature, and to make the case that this was bad for Vermont and bad for the American people to base F-35 jet at the airport in South Burlington, Vermont, where I live.
And did you manage to educate some people through that tactic?
Well, I think it did have quite an impact. After that vote, unfortunately, Speaker of the House and several other leaders decided that Vermont is going to end its opportunity for citizens to run for that office, and they unfortunately changed the requirements. But I think it did have the impact that I wanted, that we were able to speak to our legislature as citizens and place our demand that this dangerous weapon not be based in the most heavily populated area of Vermont. The Vermont Air National Guard has as its purpose, and its members are pledged to defend Vermonters, not to attack them. And this plane actually is on the attack against thousands of people living in the area around the airport. It's the most densely populated area of Vermont. There are 124,000 people living in seven towns immediately within the 5 mile, 5 miles of the runway. And it's not a place to put a plane that has the two serious dangers to people that this plane uniquely has.
And what are those?
Well, the two dangers are noise and crash. The World Health Organization says that half the children who live in what the Air Force says is its high noise zone will suffer cognitive impairment. impairment. That means loss in reading, memory, speech perception, and academic performance from the intense noise that they're going to be subjected to. And for older people, it's a vascular disease. And the Air Force says that more than 6,600 Vermonters will live in that noise danger zone when the Air Force brings the F-35 to Vermont here in 3 years. And of those families with the 6,600 people, that's more than 1,000 children living in the danger zone, subjected to the cognitive impairment.
And they're buying those people out and moving them out of their houses or just leaving them there?
Well, that's a great question. The Air Force has already moved 100 families close to 150 families out of their homes and demolished the homes in the town I live in, South Burlington, which is adjacent to the runway, sideways to the runway. Because of F-16 noise, we're already basing the F-16 here in Vermont. But the F-35 is more than four times louder. And the noise from the F-35 isn't just going to be in the areas affected by the F-16. It's going to extend much further out, especially at the ends of the runway, where right now with the F-16, the city of Winooski, which has about 6,000 or 7,000 people, is outside the noise zone of the F-16, but most of the city will be blanketed by this intense noise zone from the F-35. And that means that we're going to have a tremendous number of houses, or 1,500 houses, that would have to be purchased and demolished under the same program, Federal Aviation Administration program, that they purchased and demolished the houses in South Burlington. But they're not going to do it. There's no way they're going to get the funding or the desire to, and they've already announced that they're not going to be purchasing any more homes and demolished. So we're going to have not only a health effect on Winooski and other towns around the airport, but we're also going to have an economic effect as these home values decline. And so the people of Vermont, thousands of people in Vermont, particularly children, are going to be paying a heavy price for basing the F-35 here. But that's not the only reason. Noise was the first thing that we really found out about. And it was from the Air Force's own report, its own environmental impact statement, in which the airport gave all the facts that we reported to the public. The Air Force environmental impact statement was tens of thousands of pages. And we studied them and we reported on them. I personally reported many of the articles I wrote. But there's another huge problem with the F-35 for basing in a heavily populated area, and that's the crash risk and the crash consequences. The Air Force report said that the F-35 is going to have an intensely high risk of crashing, especially during its first few years of operation. This has been the fact with all advanced military jets going back. The F-15, the F-16, the F-22, all of them had extremely high crash risks during their first years of operation. And the Air Force says that the F-35 is going to be similar to the F-22 in its crash risk. This isn't me saying it. It's the Air Force. But the F-35 has far more crash consequence when it crashes than the F-16 does. The F-16 is made of aluminum. Its body and wings are aluminum. So when it crashes, all right, you get a certain level of danger from the fuel burning, and it's got whatever else is burnable, is combustible on that plane. But the F-35 is primarily, or 42%, made of carbon composite aeronautical military composite material that's combustible. And not only that, the F-35 has a stealth, what they call a stealth coating. It's a coating designed to absorb instead of reflecting radar like aluminum does. Aluminum just reflects the radar so the enemy can see the plane, but the stealth coating on the F-35 absorbs the radar. It doesn't get reflected back. It can fly in without being seen, and it can attack countries with sophisticated radar. This is what it's designed for. But the crash risk is very much in, crash consequences are very much enhanced by the stealth coating, which is also combustible. And when they burn in burno created when it crashes, and the fuel burns, catching the body on fire and turning what is a carbon composite material, aeronautical materials, into a plume of dangerous toxic chemicals, particulates, and fibers, then we've got a serious health hazard carried by the wind. And 8,600 pounds of carbon composite and stealth coating go up into smoke and are breathed by people and animals in the surrounding area, depending on which way the wind blows. It could very well blow towards the wealthier neighborhood. They're not out of the risk zone of a crash,
yeah.
Or like they are with the noise issue. Winooski, as I mentioned, the town I mentioned that's subjected mostly to the noise, is one of the poorer towns in Vermont, and it's got lots of immigrants. But the crash risk could be anywhere. So it's an equal opportunity destroyer, this plane. It's not just, the people who live in adjacent towns where the plane might crash, which could be anywhere in the vicinity of the airport as it takes off and circles around, could be seriously affected by either one of these factors. And so what we're saying is to the Vermont Air National Guard, and especially to our politicians, you have a job to protect Vermonters. This is the purpose of our Air National Guard. And it is being subverted and destroyed by basing F-35 jets in the most densely populated area of Vermont. The Air Force says the crash should not be allowed to happen. In a report about the combustion products from this plane, where the Air Force experts analyzed what would be coming out and gave tables of data, they said, look, this isn't something that should be allowed to happen. A crash should not be allowed to happen in a populated area. Well, yeah. It shouldn't be, and that's why it shouldn't be based in the most densely populated area of Vermont.
We're speaking with James Mark Lease, who is a founding member of the Stop the F-35 Coalition in Burlington, Vermont. Jimmy, the plane that has this many flaws and this many dangers surely must be free or inexpensive, or we wouldn't be opting for it, right? What's the price tag on this thing?
This is a hugely expensive project. It's the most expensive military project ever. It's going to cost way more than $1 trillion over the 50 years. And that money is going to be channeled from taxpayers all over the United States to the corporation. It's just a huge boondoggle, because it's not just that this plane is dangerous to the locations where it's based, but it's also a ripoff. It's totally an incompetent plane. It can't, the experts who design planes like this say that it's slow, it can't turn, climb, or run. It needs other planes to defend it from adversaries when it gets into this way you can see it visually. So when they get close enough so you can see it, it's not going to be able to defend itself. And it's not just the trillion-dollar program itself. It's also the cost of the wars that this plane is going to help us get involved in. For example, Iraq alone, just the Iraq war, according to a recent Brown University study, has already cost $4.7 trillion. This is a transfer of money from working people in our country to big corporations that goes on and on and on. And it's something that has to stop. We need the political revolution intensely. We need it, you know, we have such a corrupt system. It could be late night comedy. It's like, here we have Lockheed Martin building this plane. They've built about 100 of them so far. Billions and billions of dollars have been transferred to Lockheed. They take a tiny portion of that money and they donate it for electioneering expenses of politicians all around the country who keep voting for more billions and billions of dollars. And then more and more of these planes are generated. We have more and more of this attack capability. This plane is in it. As I said, it's got a stealth coating. Well, what's that for? It allows the U.S. to penetrate air defenses of sophisticated enemies and attack them for what the U.S. has specialized in over the last number of years, which is regime change. We've gone in and attacked other countries to change their governments. And this is what this plane is really designed for, not for protecting our own shores from attack, because you wouldn't need all the stealth coating for that. What you need it for is to penetrate and drop bombs on other countries. And this is the political revolution, that Bernie Sanders, our Vermont senator, has been talking about, is very much this is very much related to this F-35. This is a totally corrupt system. The plane is part of this terrible policy of regime change that the U.S. has embarked in,
yeah,
and transferring billions of dollars to these military contracts.
So, I mean, it's a plane that is designed for something horrible, to kill lots of people and endanger us and stir up enemies, and it doesn't work anyway, and it poisons the air we breathe and endangers our children's brains and so forth, and it costs a lot of money, but surely it's a jobs program. I mean, they wouldn't be so philanthropically building it in little bits and pieces across so many dozens of different states if it weren't, you know, a good social job-creating program, right?
Right, but there are two really strong arguments that it's not a job-creating program. First, the Air Force itself, to its credit, honestly said that no Air Guard jobs will be created if the F-35 is based in Vermont, and no Air Guard jobs are at risk if the F-35 does not come. The Air Force says, look, the Vermont Air Guard is going to get some other mission if you don't get the F-35. And so, you know, we have our two senators who are supporting F-35 basing, including Bernie, and their reasoning is wrong. Their argument is with the Air Force, and the F-35 is working against the political revolution that Bernie says we need. But it's not just the Air Guard jobs. It's all the jobs created by the F-35 to build the parts and manufacture the plane and service the plane and all the other things. Most of the money is going to be paid those kinds of jobs. But amazingly, that kind of job creation is seriously flawed. Economics professors at the University of Massachusetts wrote a report about military spending and showed that money spent for the military programs actually cost jobs. And nearly twice as many good jobs are created when the government spends money on education or health care or housing or infrastructure or even just not spending the money at all and letting it stay in the pockets of the taxpayer so that we can spend it ourselves. Any of those are much better ways of creating jobs than spending it on military programs. So the F-35 program is actually costing a huge loss in jobs that could otherwise be created if we didn't do the F-35 program. There's no good reason for Americans to build this plane.
And how evil and sociopathic it would be to make that argument if it were true, that, you know, this instrument of mass murder, destabilization, and endangerment which, by the way, even when it does work and doesn't crash, is an incredible polluter of the Earth and its climate, that it creates jobs. I mean,
that's right.
What sort of a moral defense would that be if it were true?
That's right. There's plenty of criminal activity that creates jobs. We wouldn't be saying, look, a business person who sells heroin to addicts has a job, and heroin distribution creates jobs, and that's a good reason to support it, would we? So we would oppose that and make it wrongful, illegal, and immoral. And the same is true for other kinds of job creators, including these military jobs. We have to stop, as you said, it's a polluter. We have to stop drilling and killing for oil and other fossil fuels. This is a endangerment to our planet. You know, the F-35 is not going to protect us against the Zika virus. It's not going to give us health care or help anyone see a doctor. It's not going to put homeless people into housing. When we drill and kill for oil, we actually endanger the whole planet. The ice is going to keep melting and the oceans are going to keep rising. It's not going to do anything to stop the vastly more powerful hurricanes and floods and droughts and forest fires. That's really our trade-off here. We can continue the policy of wars for oil and wars to regime change, and we can deceive ourselves that we're creating something useful about it. And
yeah,
we can follow these Piper politicians and military generals who want to bring us into more and more wars. Or we can really defend our state of Vermont and other states where it's going to be based and other countries where it's going to be based and really protect ourselves from the genuine threats that we face. And to do that, we cannot be building planes like the F-35. We've got to organize a huge campaign worldwide to stop the F-35, to stop the whole project of regime change politics emanating from the United States and put our country back on a path, or for the first time on a path, of sustainable development.
Well, I know that, that you and I and groups in Vermont that are looking at the F-35 and organizations in Fairbanks, Alaska, where they also want to put the F-35 near there, and in other countries. The State Department has got several other countries now buying this boondoggle. We've started a petition this week at rootsaction.org where people can sign on that they want to cancel the F-35, and that gives all the sort of background information that you've been giving us on this show. This seems like an encouraging and somewhat new approach to me that is taking a local issue and a global issue and trying to address it locally and globally. What potential do you think is there, and what can we do next?
Well, I totally agree with you, David. This is a huge step for us. Here in Vermont, we've been working on this locally. We have been in contact with other groups around the country, but this is the first time that we are really organizing a coordinated effort with the petition campaign that's being launched today. So people can sign on nationally and internationally to the petition and demand that our government officials think twice about this program, put a stop to it entirely, and certainly put a stop to basing it in any area where it's going to be anywhere near large numbers or even small numbers of people. This is not a weapon system that we should be supporting, and that this is a real opportunity with this petition for building the kind of mass movement needed to stop it.
Yeah, we can build a coalition and build a list and take further steps. People can go and sign, and organizations can go and sign at rootsaction.org, and I hope everyone listening does and asks others to do so, and asks your organizations to consider signing on. We have just a minute and a half left. Jimmy, this is a plane put out by something called the Department of Defense, and people think of it as somehow defensive, but you've talked about its stealth capabilities and what it's for. Is it actually defensive in any way? Is there any plus side to this thing whatsoever?
Well, I can't think of any, and nobody has articulated one. The supporters of the F-35 don't talk about it being a defensive weapon. Nobody in, for example, if it's based here in Vermont, we don't expect New Hampshire, Massachusetts, New York, or Canada to attack us so that it can be used to defend us. It is not as capable as the F-16 it's replacing to repel, to get into a dogfight with, say, if Soviet plane fighters attacked. Or there aren't Soviet fighters anymore anyway. If Russian fighters or Chinese fighters or whoever else can imagine, they're not going to attack. That would be crazy for them to do it. It's not designed for defending. It's designed, with its stealth coating, to penetrate radar. It's designed for attacking.
James Mark Leese is a founding member of the Stop the F-35 Coalition in Burlington, Vermont. James, thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you very much, David, for doing this.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Countersmith.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in their feature, What to Know About the Dakota Access Pipeline Protests, Time magazine told readers that environmental activists say the pipeline would contribute to man-made climate change. Quote, they insist that fossil fuels, including the vast reserves in the Bakken Shale, need to be kept in the ground to protect the world from the worst effects of climate change, close quote. Presenting what has been the world scientific consensus for many years as the insistent opinion of activists is one way to undermine the significance of what's happening in North Dakota. But corporate media's main method has been to simply ignore it. If that maneuver is failing, it's due to independent journalists working to get the stories from Standing Rock out, despite on-the-ground intimidation and big media's studied disinterest. We'll get a report back from Rose Aguilar. She's the host of Your Call, the daily call-in show on KALW in San Francisco. She'll join us from her second reporting trip, where she's filing dispatches from Standing Rock for 48hills.org and The Nation. Also on the show, fossil fuels aren't the only industry presenting real harms and risks to the planet and the human beings in their production. But unlike oil or grapes or even clothing, relatively few people think about where their cell phone comes from. The story of Samsung smartphones catching fire brought that company into the spotlight for a minute, but our guest explains that stories on the potential danger to some consumers missed a bigger, deeper story about the dangers Samsung and corporations like them pose for their own workers and the countries where they operate. We'll get that story from Michelle Chen, contributing writer at The Nation, contributing editor at In These Times and Dissent Magazine, and co-producer, co-host of Dissent's podcast, Belabored. That's coming up, and we're going to get right to it. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. What's happening right now in North Dakota is reflective of many things: the violent desperation of extractive industry, the willingness of the state to act as its enforcers, counterposed with the peaceful power of people gathered in simple defense of the water, land, and life of their community and the wider world. The events around Standing Rock also seem to sound another death knell for corporate media as a site of critical news and debate, or of a vigorous defense for the right of people to stand up to power. If you're following the fight around the Dakota Access Pipeline, you aren't following it on the broadcast news. Fortunately, we have non-corporate media who can bring us information about what's going on, bring us the voices of the people involved. And, as we've seen, they do this reporting at some risk, only underscores its importance. We're joined now by Rose Aguilar, host of Your Call on KALW, local public radio in San Francisco, and author of Red Highways, A Journey into the Heartland. She joins us now from North Dakota, where she's been gathering and sharing stories for days. Welcome back to Counterspin, Rose Aguilar.
Hi, Janine. Thank you.
Well, I guess I just want to ask you, what are some of the stories that you've been able to bring from North Dakota that you couldn't have done, you know, from your office in San Francisco? What does it mean to be there?
It just means so much. I was actually supposed to go home earlier this week, but I decided to stay because there are just so many rich stories to tell here. People are really frustrated and so shaken by last Thursday's violent crackdown, but they are determined. And I think it's important to note that the pipeline at this point, most of it has already been built, and the pipeline is being essentially protected by police and military vehicles. So if you watched any of the videos of the actions in the last couple of months, what you saw were water protectors on the route of the pipeline preventing workers from getting to it. Workers were bussed in and then bussed out. And so the police cracked down really hard. They arrested over 100 people. And now that pipeline is literally being protected. The water protectors can no longer get to it. So as you can imagine, people are so frustrated. They feel like the police are protecting Energy Transfer Partners. That's the company that's constructing the $3.8 billion Dakota Access Oil Pipeline. They're very frustrated because they say sacred sites are being bulldozed. In fact, when you're standing in the camp at night, it's just thrown in your face because there are really bright lights up on the hill. There's a lot of Humvees. There's ATVs that are crossing the land. In fact, I have interviewed people who were on the front lines praying. And as the police pushed them back last Thursday, the construction began immediately. So the construction was happening as people were being arrested.
Well, and yet we hear that high ups are saying, including Barack Obama, well, maybe it will be rerouted. Maybe something will go differently. And yet it sounds as though it's really kind of underway already. You know?
Well, the construction is happening 24/7. What we're talking about right now is a 20-mile section of the pipe that would go under the Missouri River. And that Missouri River provides drinking water to 18 million people. It's the main source of water for the tribe. And I think this piece of information should be the lead in every story. An early proposal called for the pipeline to cross the Missouri River just north of Bismarck, which is the capital of North Dakota. That area is 90% white, but the route was rejected because of a threat to Bismarck's water supply. And then it was rerouted to basically go to the tribe's doorstep. Now, I've been trying to get answers to this question. Why was it rerouted? I have left so many messages for Energy Transfer Partners, the governor of North Dakota, the Army Corps of Engineers, the Department of Justice. I cannot get an answer. Journalists need to be asking this question. The Bismarck Tribune, which is the local paper here, has reported that the route was rejected because of a threat to the water supply. But why is it not okay for one group of people and it is okay for another group of people? And people here know this. They're talking about this. Talking about the human side, I think it's really important for everyone to know that there are loads of cars and buses coming. People are flocking to Standing Rock because they want to express solidarity. And I met yesterday Carol Masden, who's a 69-year-old Native woman from Pennsylvania. She took a bus to Standing Rock. It took her 3 days to get here. She was on the front line praying. She was arrested. She spent 3 days in jail, including 3 hours in solitary for fist bumping someone. She's been camping for 3 weeks, and it's cold here. She now has pneumonia. The police took her ID and her Medicare card. She still doesn't have it. And in order, obviously, to get her meds, she needs those cards. She has been charged with a felony and has to stay here until December to make a court appearance. She also said a DNA sample was taken. I have interviewed so many people who were arrested, charged with felonies, some strip searched, others were made to take off their clothing and only have one layer of clothing, and they're being asked for DNA samples. Now, I finally, after 2 months of trying to get an interview with the sheriff's department, I was finally able to speak with Rob Keller, the spokesman there, and when I said, why are people being tested? Why are they giving DNA samples? He said, I know nothing about that. So I'm going to look into this because some people were told if you don't give a sample, you're going to get a second felony. But there's this federal DNA database, and why are they taking DNA samples? So there are a lot of questions that journalists need to be asking here. And come here and interview people. Every single day, there's something happening. I was driving to Bismarck to do my radio show, and I stumbled upon piles and piles of things that were taken from the frontline camps on Thursday, and the police just dumped it. And people here were crying because it included sacred items like feathers and pipes. And this is the kind of thing that's happening, and you can only tell the story if you're on the ground for, you know, more than 2 days. I mean, some people have flown in. Sandy Tolan has done great reporting for the LA Times. Antonia Yuhas has done great reporting for Pacific Standard. But in order to really get the true sense of what's happening, you have to stay for at least a week to get the real story.
And you would think that reporters would be curious, you know, would be genuinely curious to see with their own eyes and that we would see more of the big guys. But fortunately, we have seen, it's been a wonderful showing for independent media or so-called alternative media, where people have been willing to go and listen to folks and bring those voices back. You know, everybody's in favor of protest, of dissent when it's abstract, but to actually take part in it is very, very different. You're talking about people being pushed around, being put in solitary, having their things taken away, being sometimes strip searched, being given DNA samples. It's the treatment of people by law enforcement for what is, we understand, a protected activity for peaceful protest, I think is really eye-opening. I think it should be alarming to people.
It's so true. And to see the photos of these MRAPs, these military vehicles, these men who look like they're going to Iraq and Afghanistan. Antonia Juhas has covered Afghanistan, and she was on the front line. She said, I never thought I would see anything like this in the United States. Now, when I spoke to Rob Keller with the Morton County Sheriff's Department, he said that, yes, we are putting a call out to the rest of the country, to police departments, to come assist us. There are definitely more than five states represented. And when you drive along 1806, the highway to get to the main camp, there's a National Army Guard checkpoint. And right next to that, there's a large law enforcement tent, camp, really. There's a ton of tents there. And that's where the law enforcement are staying. And then you have to turn around and you have to take another highway. So Highway 1806 is being shut down today in order to have the pipeline protected. And the media need to be asking questions about the militarization of these police forces. Is this the new norm in the United States? Who's paying for this? How long is this pipeline going to be protected? Who is ultimately making these decisions? It's been really hard to get answers to these questions. But if more journalists start asking them, then maybe we'll get answers, and that's what we need.
Listeners should know that it's not just Amy Goodman from Democracy Now! Who was charged with rioting. It's also documentary filmmakers Dia Schlossberg and Lindsay Goodwin Grazel, four journalists with the independent news outlet Unicorn Riot. This piece that I read by Sabrina King of the ACLU of Wyoming reminds us that five protesters who were part of an action, a different action that temporarily shut down five pipelines carrying Canadian tar sands oil, one of them is facing 81 years in prison and nearly $100,000 in fines for nonviolent actions in which no one was hurt. So I wonder truly if some reporters aren't frankly intimidated by the thought of doing journalism here.
That could be the case, because look at how people are treated. And if you have a felony on your record, I mean, that is a serious, serious charge.
Yes.
You know, the other thing, Janine, is when you come here, a lot of natives are afraid to talk because of the way they've been treated. I mean, I met a woman yesterday who would not let me state her name publicly or take a photo. She said, I'm afraid that my children are in danger if I talk about what happened to me. And so in order to get the real story, you've got to create relationships. You have to stay here. You have to get to know people. Then they introduce you to other people. And it's so important to get the native voices. What I'm finding is some of the videos I've been seeing from some of these independent outlets, and they're doing great work, but it's starting to be sort of majority white.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's so important when journalists come here to go to extra lengths to be sure to get the native voices. And sometimes it's hard, because they don't want to talk, they don't want to be filmed, and you can understand why. But that's why it's important to actually spend time here and create relationships. And you mentioned journalism, and I also just want to give a shout-out to the native media.
Right.
Like Indian Country Today has been doing excellent reporting, and they offer crucial historical context about treaties, for example. I mean, this is a time when we all should be educating ourselves about the history of this country and about broken treaties. A lot of people I've met here say, look, this is not about what happened 500 years ago. We want people to know that and learn that. This is about what they're doing to us today. We are being arrested for praying today. They're breaking our pipes today. And while we're here to fight for water, this is about so much more. It's about embracing a different way of life, because the path that we're on now is just not sustainable.
I want to just ask you finally, what is the feeling like? I understand that people are frustrated and frightened in reaction to the circumstances, but what is the mood in the gatherings that you've been at?
Oh, so many. I was at one of the nearby hotels where people are coming to shower, because there's no shower at the camp. People are camping in the cold weather, and I passed two young women who were just maced at a recent action. They were covered in white. Their hair was all tangled, visibly shaken up. So you've got that. But then you also have prayer circles. At night, people sit around the fire, and the elders speak about their lives, about the importance of this movement. And then you have flags from so many different tribes across the country. There are members of about 300 different tribal nations who are here or have been here. So you see that. And then just the everyday conversations, young people coming from nearby reservations so their brothers find purpose. Older people coming to connect with people from other tribes. I met a member of the American Indian Movement a couple days ago. He was heavily involved back in the 70s. He started crying and saying, "We have had so much conflict within our tribe. This is the first time that these seven specific different tribes have gotten together. We put all of that behind us, and now we are here together. We're basically holding hands. We're praying together for the first time." So you also get that side of it. And that's why it's so important for journalists to come here and tell these stories.
We've been speaking with Rose Aguilar. She's host of Your Call. You can hear it online at kalw.org. Rose Aguilar, thank you so much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thanks, Janine. Thank you for covering this.
Nightly News reported unblinkingly that the FAA warns there could be criminal charges brought against those who, wittingly or not, try to bring their Galaxy Note 7 smartphone on a plane. Some of those phones have been known to explode or catch fire, and that poses an unacceptable hazard to people. Well, you can read a dozen stories about the troubled Samsung devices and never learn that they can endanger people even when they work as advertised. But it isn't consumers who are imperiled. Here with the rest of the story on Samsung is Michelle Chen. She's a contributing writer at The Nation, contributing editor at In These Times and at Dissent magazine, as well as co-producer and co-host of Dissent's podcast, Belabored. She joins us now by phone. Welcome back to Counterspin, Michelle Chen.
Hi.
Well, I was startled to see your article, "Exploding Phones Are Just One of Samsung's Safety Liabilities," in The Nation, because Samsung has been getting what passes for hot seat coverage lately. One AP story said that even before the messy recalls, Samsung was being urged to improve its transparency and corporate governance. But then that turned out to be about whether the son of the chairman of the board should be allowed to join the board. Labor activists, though, and others have been concerned about Samsung for some time and not about phones catching fire. Tell us what some of those concerns are.
Yeah, I was looking specifically at a report on Samsung's global operations, primarily in manufacturing, that was published recently by the International Trade Union Confederation. I mean, it examined labor practices on several continents, countries ranging from Brazil to China to Taiwan, Vietnam, and, of course, the United States. And they're all countries with, you know, vastly different economic systems, vastly different regulatory regimes. But when it comes to Samsung's manufacturing systems, they all kind of follow the same framework of, you know, certain draconian policies that tend to degrade working conditions on a really global scale. I mean, I don't think people really realize just how wide Samsung's net is cast, because they do work with a lot of sub-suppliers that they contract out to, much like Apple does. In addition, Samsung has kind of flown under the radar because Apple tends to get a lot more media attention, both good and bad. Mm-hmm. But now that Samsung's sort of in the hot seat, I did think it was curious that the labor conditions there were not getting more attention, given that people were really afraid of their phones spontaneously combusting, when in fact there's been maybe a handful of those incidents, and none of them really anything close to the scale of the types of human rights violations that we're seeing on a daily basis, fully above board in Samsung's no-union factories.
Well, that no union seems to be very important. I'm going to get back to that, what happens when they try to form a union. But what are some of the conditions that you're talking about, some of the work conditions that folks are complaining about?
Yeah, I mean, they range from things that are actually harming their health to things that are just very poor working conditions. And this goes across the board, even for countries that are relatively poor, like Vietnam, as well as in Korea itself. And these are manufacturing facilities that operate on sort of a rapid fire, on demand level. So there's a breakneck pace of work, and they're often on very precarious contracts. Some of them are considered contingent laborers, so they do not have sort of the vested rights and protections that ordinary workers would have on the job as full employees. Samsung has found all sorts of creative ways, depending on which regulatory system they're working under, to kind of evade labor contract law and keep workers on these short-term contracts. So they're constantly cycling through these short-term jobs, even though they may be more or less perma-temps, which is an increasingly common phenomenon here in the U.S., but elsewhere it's also increasingly widespread, where you have these jobs that used to be maybe decent manufacturing jobs that used to be full-time work with union representation, and now they are being sort of de-skilled, outsourced, and atomized into these short-term stints. And that's very dangerous in terms of both the working conditions there, the physical working conditions and the mental working conditions, as well as their overall economic security. And on the public health side, there are serious environmental risks that have been flagged by official investigations that have been presided over by the Korean government. But again, because the company is so opaque in its operations and its management, you know, its managerial style, which is based on this Korean cartel system called the Chaebol, is extremely antiquated and extremely closed, and it's hard to figure out what's going on behind closed doors. This has gotten a lot of bad press from the corporate end because it's seen as bad corporate governance, but I am more worried about what it's doing to workers' bodies, because when there's no accountability in management, it's really difficult to, A, advocate on workers' behalf, and B, even know what's going on when workers are, say, dying of mysterious cancers and other things that have been found on the Samsung assembly line.
Yeah, you write about the mysterious illness that some, particularly young women who are working on semiconductors, have been coming down with. But then also psychosocial problems. And in fact, another thing that you document is a worker suicide from a metal worker. Tell me a little bit about that, because that seems to get at something that I think is people that is part of it. The idea that workers would actually take their own lives really speaks to something deeply wrong, you know, in the system.
Yeah, this was actually back in October 2013. There's a 32-year-old worker who reportedly self-immolated after being pushed into extreme hardship through targeted auditing, the quote from the report, which is, I think, a euphemism for, you know, being basically demonized and pilloried by his management for simply trying to organize workers at his workplace. I don't know much about the worker's background, but I imagine he was probably a leader of sorts among his coworkers. And for him to fall into those depths of despair really, I think, indicates something about the kind of psychological climate that prevails within this corporate structure. It actually sparked a lot of protests after the death, because people were saying, look, if workers are being driven to these extremes, then what does that say about the day-to-day work that we're doing? Evidently, Samsung has maintained its no union policy, and that goes really across the board. And again, because there's no union representation, it becomes sort of a chicken and the egg question.
Right.
The unions have been unable to organize, at least above ground. From what I hear, based on this ITUC report, it seems that there is some underground organizing going on. But again, when you can be fired at any time, that's really not an ideal situation when you want to build a global movement, which is what these workers really need, because, you know, their employer is a multinational giant, basically. And unless there's some global baseline for workers' rights across Samsung supply chains, these issues are never really going to be remedied on a systemic level. So rather than this race to the bottom, what a lot of these global labor federations are saying is that there needs to be cross-sectoral, horizontal organizing across the supply chain.
it's not obviously just Samsung. This is a problem that is going to be, you call it a multinational union-free zone. And I think it's, I mean, this is the way we're seeing corporations behave. Countries have laws. They might be labor laws, environmental laws, but then these corporations, they're almost, it's like Vatican City or something. They're almost a country unto themselves. I mean, they really can operate however they want to in complete disregard for the prevailing conditions or laws in the country that they're in. So we really don't, and that's Walmart and that's, you know, H&M and everybody else as well. So it sounds as though we really don't have the mechanisms to govern these entities.
Yeah, and it's important to underscore that this is the model that free trade deals promulgate around the world, right? And the U.S. is a chief purveyor of this, and we have a trade deal with South Korea. And unions on both sides of the Pacific have been mobilizing against these free trade deals because they understand that it's really not about lowering tariffs or promoting imports or exports. It has much less to do with the sort of concrete material aspects of commerce and or actual production of things that are useful. And it's much more about expanding corporate power on this sort of supranational level. I mean, most of the free trade deals that have been pushed so far, including the pending Trans-Pacific Partnership and, you know, the TISA and all these other, this whole alphabet soup of trade deals that are coming up and being negotiated behind closed doors by international trade ministers, one of the bulwarks of this model is an investor tribunal system that allows corporations to basically act as states and sue other states,
right.
When they find that some sort of regulatory stricture is impinging on their absolute right to free trade. So that sounds abstract on some level, and it echoes this libertarian notion that the best kind of trade is unbridled and free-flowing capitalism across borders. But what open borders mean for corporations is really about restricting workers' rights and restricting environmental regulations and all these other protections that states have built up over the years precisely to check the power of big business. And that's something that really goes beyond Samsung at this point.
We've been speaking with Michelle Chen. You can find her article, Exploding Phones Are Just One of Samsung's Safety Liabilities, online still at thenation.com. Michelle Chen, thank you for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. For more information, you can check out our website, fair.org. The show is engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
Not everything is climate change. A little later, we'll talk with one of the world's top disaster experts, Robert Muir Woods, about his new book, The Cure for Catastrophe: How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. But first, according to the Center for Disease Control, industrial food is the number two cause of death in the United States and in most developed countries. We'll talk about the local food revolution with a veteran in that struggle. In November 2012, Colorado startled the world by legalizing marijuana for personal use. There's another movement coming out of that state which is even more far-reaching. It's being called a revolution that literally starts at ground level. It's the local food revolution. In fact, that's the title of a new book released October 18th. Michael Brownlee is the author of The Local Food Revolution: How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. 5 years ago, I interviewed Michael as a leader in the Transition Town movement in America. I think this goes even deeper, reaching right into your refrigerator, into your body, and into our troubling future. Michael, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. It's great to be with you today.
Please tell our listeners what you've been doing that led you into this call for a revolution.
Well, for the last almost 10 years, we've been primarily focused on localizing our food supply here in Colorado. You know, we came out of the relocalization movement that was originally started by Julian Darley and Post Carbon Institute, attempting to find ways that our communities could meet their most essential needs as locally as possible. And we focused on food pretty early because we realized that that's the area where we were most vulnerable because we were dependent on a global industrial food supply. And should that supply line be cut, then we would be in trouble. So we have been learning about the process of communities localizing their food supply a long way. And even though we've been at this for a good decade, and even though lots of wonderful and beautiful things have happened in the local food movement, in reality, we haven't moved the needle very far. So here in Colorado, of all of the food that we eat here, only about 1 or 2% is actually grown within the state. We import almost everything that we eat, and we export almost everything that we grow, which is sort of an outstanding example of an unsustainable economic basis.
I'd like to read out a paragraph, a powerful paragraph, from an article you wrote at localfoodshift.pub. You say we have, quote, a food system that keeps our population in control, herded into CAFOs we call cities, fed a diet laced with chemicals and drugs that keeps our people addicted and trapped, and keeps the unholy alliance ever more wealthy and ever more powerful, we are in effect being ranched. This is tyranny through food. Well, that's big. Let's unpack it a bit. I've done a program on concentrated animal feedlot operations, or CAFOs. And is that really what we've become in cities where most people live?
In effect, that's what we have become, or we are headed in that direction. By concentrating our population this way, it is the most efficient way for the unholy alliance of big ag and big food and big pharma to make us their customers. So actually, we have become almost completely dependent on this unholy alliance for our food supply. So they are in control. They dominate our food system in this country and in most parts of the world. And the reality is that the food that we are being fed much like the food that our animals in CAFOs are being fed, it is not good for our health. It's not good for our economy either. It is only beneficial to those behind the Unholy Alliance who are interested only in consolidating wealth and power. So this situation has arisen fairly gradually since World War II, so that we're really not aware of it, and we have become unconscious of the reality that we are dependently addicted to this global industrial food system.
Well, like those cows in the CAFO operations or the pigs, we're getting sick. We've got a rampant diabetes. We've got people are grossly overweight. We've got all kinds of health problems. And to overcome that, we're using all kinds of things that we shouldn't be using in medicines and pharmaceuticals. So I really can see the parallel.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's true. And of course, this creates big financial opportunity. So we have the most expensive healthcare system in the world, and many of our healthcare problems, I would say the majority of our healthcare problems these days, are food-related. We heard that the Center for Disease Control some years ago said that the number two cause of death in this country is food, second only to tobacco. Really, a startling indication of how out of whack our society has become.
Now, Michael, I'm hearing more about food deserts. What are they and how would you describe one?
So a food desert is a place where, I forget the exact distance, but it's where people cannot access grocery stores easily. I think it's, you know, within a mile or two, something like that. So there are many parts of our cities across the country that are food deserts where people do not have access even to supermarkets. They have to travel some distance by bus or car, or even worse, they go to the corner markets in those cities where only the worst kinds of food is available. So that's the more official, traditional way of looking at food deserts. But I tend to look at it somewhat differently. I feel that we all, almost all of us, live in something of a food desert in that almost no one has access to fresh, healthy, locally grown food except the people who are relatively wealthy in that community.
So, Michael, it's great for the few who made it to a patch of dirt to start growing food, and I'm one of them, but let's face it, many of our listeners don't have that option right now. Some work at two jobs to get by, or they're students with or parents with a part-time job on top. Some have health problems, or they live in an apartment. How can the millions of people now disenfranchised from the land participate in this food revolution?
There are lots of ways that people can participate. You know, certainly we all need to be growing as much of our own food as possible. And even people who are living in high-rise apartment buildings can grow some of their own food. I mean, they can have pots on the balcony or in the kitchen window or something like that where they're growing a little bit. And while that may not amount to much in terms of the amount of food that they might produce for themselves, the experience of doing that and what that awakens in people is extremely important. What we're going to have to do is to shift the balance of power that the Unholy Alliance has over our food supply is simply to stop buying and eating industrially produced food. This is something that we all can do. Maybe we can't go cold turkey 100% in one day, but gradually we have to phase that stuff out of our diet and replace it with food that is grown as locally as possible, preferably by farmers and ranchers who we know or at least know enough about to feel confident that the food that they're producing for us is healthy, really is good for us. We can all get involved politically on a local level in the shaping of policy. There are many policies that need to be changed because most of the policies related to food and agriculture in this country are actually resistant to local food production. They are in support of industrial agriculture and big food. So that's something that as citizens we can all participate in. We can all vote. So those are just some of the ways that we can get involved.
And I'd toss in community gardens. You know, they're possible everywhere, Michael, even in the inner city. Vancouver started a couple right downtown, and one of them is in the poorest part of the city. They said, oh, well, that'll never work. People will just rip off all the product. Didn't happen. It worked out great. So nowhere's really impossible for food.
That's right. And one of the most exciting projects that we've seen in Colorado is in probably our worst food desert in the city of Denver. This is a community called Westwood. And there's a nonprofit organization that started there, I believe, 4 or 5 years ago that focused on teaching people how to grow as much of their own food as possible, how to garden. And so there are now 400 families in that community who are raising most of their own food. The community has now gathered together to actually develop their own grocery store and food hub right in the community. So this is an outstanding example of what's possible even in the most economically oppressed parts of our city.
And I'd like to tell listeners about a new startup in British Columbia. There's a website called soilmate.com, and hundreds of thousands of people across North America are already using it to connect up with local farmers and grocery stores that sell local food. What other sort of web-based resources have you heard about, Michael?
Well, there are certainly many, but the challenge that we face is while there are lots and lots of wonderful projects, thousands across the country, most of them are small and fairly isolated. At some point, we have to shift from this kind of siloed effort towards local food to organizing together as communities to localize our food supply on a system-wide level. This is sort of the next leap that has to be taken in the local food movement so that we could get to a place where in the next couple of decades, perhaps, where we are at a 20 or 25% local food in a particular region, whereas typically right now we're at 1 or 2% across the country. The exception, of course, is the state of Vermont, where after 15 years of concerted effort there, they are at about 7% local food in the state of Vermont. But that's a very small state. You know, the whole state's population is just about the size of Denver, and they've been working at it for quite a while. So we need to learn to think systemically. We need to learn how to bring these various organizations and companies working on local food to collaborate and cooperate together so that what we're building actually is regional food sheds in which the food supply is highly localized. That's the direction that we need to be going. And to get there, it really requires communities deciding together to take on the project of food localization, setting real goals, making that a priority in their community. And I think we made a strategic error in the local food movement early on by allowing local food to be viewed primarily as a lifestyle choice for the privileged. You know, farmers markets and CSAs and farm dinners and ecotourism and upscale restaurants have all tended to reinforce this misconception. So we say that we need to now correct that error by beginning to make it very clear that primarily because of global warming, food localization is an absolutely urgent necessity everywhere. We're learning from our scientists that the impact of global warming on global food production will be quite profound. And this is fairly new information. It really hasn't gotten out for public discussion much yet, but In January, I believe, of this year, there was a major climate conference in Tucson. One of the speakers was Dr. David Battisti, who's head of the Atmospheric Sciences Department up in the University of Washington. And what Battisti is saying is that just due to the increase in temperature that's projected by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, we will see at least a 30 to 40% reduction in crop production globally by the end of the century. And that doesn't include the related impacts besides heat. I mean, things like the increased pest pressure, things like the increasingly unstable weather and devastating weather events, and maybe most importantly, loss of soil because of erosion, because of salinization, and because of sea level rise. So when you factor in these other related impacts of global warming, it's not too unrealistic to conclude that we will see a reduction of global food production capacity by about half, even by the middle of this century, certainly long before the end of this century. So that makes this a global food emergency, and it makes it a local food emergency everywhere to the degree that we're dependent on a global industrial food system. So suddenly now we need to shift from local food being seen as a lifestyle choice to being seen as food localization being seen as the most important and most urgent social cause on the planet today. This is the shift that we need to make. And to do that, we say, is going to require a local food revolution.
You have my vote. On Radio EcoShock, we are talking with Michael Brownlee, author of The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. And I appreciate that you put that in uncertain times. I think, Michael, we have the phenomenon of the preppers. I'm kind of a prepper. I've got food in the basement against hard times. But I realize, especially talking to you, that it's not going to work if a few individuals can feed themselves but the whole community cannot when some sort of crisis arises. And it could be an economic crisis. There are many threats to our food system right now. Would you talk about that?
Well, certainly there are. I mean, there could be disruptions along the way at any time, and there already are in certain parts of the country. Sometimes it's because of weather. Sometimes it's because of conflict or war. Sometimes it's political reasons. Sometimes it's because of breakdown in the fossil fuel system, like happened in Cuba. But our food supply is the global industrial food supply. We know that it's profoundly unsustainable, but it's increasingly unstable. And this is what people are mostly not aware of. So if we look out into the future, we can see that we're headed into a time where these kinds of disruptions will be increasingly frequent and that our food supply will dwindle. It will be radically diminished, you know, beginning in the next couple of decades, I would say. And what most people are not aware of is that we're actually entering into a new era on this planet. It's been called by many the Anthropocene. It is an era that's been brought about by the way that we've been living on the planet. And in reality, this has the primary factor in this has been the way that we have been feeding ourselves. So the global industrial food system now is the largest industry on the planet, the most destructive industry on the planet. It is the number one contributor to global warming. It is the single greatest cause of the sixth mass extinction of species on the planet. And now it is bringing to an end an entire geological era and diminishing the planet's ability to support life. So we are entering into, because of all of this, what you could call a new dark age. In fact, John Michael Greer just recently published a book you might have seen called Dark Age America, in which he is based upon the history of collapses of civilization in the past. He projects out what the next 500 years could look like in this country because of what we have unleashed here. So one of the really interesting things that he suggests is that when a civilization collapses, and of course many have in the past, they always do, that the population will be decreased by about 95% over the 100 to 300 years following the collapse of that civilization. So he projects that over the next 100 to 300 years that the population of North America could dwindle down to about 25 million people. And that wouldn't be because of cataclysmic events, but because of fundamental changes in the way that we live on the planet. He sees the whole global population reducing down to about 350 million people over the next, you know, up to 300 years. We're going into radically different and very challenging, difficult times ahead. And the only way that we have as a people of surviving through this time is by building local food systems that can be kind of our lifeboat through the dark ages of the Anthropocene.
Well, that's dark enough. Let's look at some of the tools that you offer to at least put that off or survive better or adapt, let's say. And one place we can look for guidance is into the past, where humans really depended on what they could grow right around them. And I'm thinking of the early American colonists, for example. They would do things like harvest rhubarb and other roots and then force them to grow in the dark winter basements by adding heat. Can we get more tips from the past?
Well, I think we can. Certainly, I'm not an expert on that, but there's a real challenge that we have right now, and that is that we just have way too many people to feed. You know, it's not that we don't have enough food, it's more that we have too many people. So we think about this here in Colorado, where we have about 5.5 million people living in this state. The population has increased dramatically. The population of our state is expected to double by 2050, which is kind of a scary thought. But if we look at what it would take to feed the people in our state with local food, we realize that it would be almost impossible to ramp up production enough to be able to do that. So it means that we would have to import a significant amount of our food still, you know, for maybe for the next few decades. But that situation is true almost everywhere. So that tells us that we are a population in overshoot. And so if we think systemically about this, I think that we will see increasingly the kind of response that we're beginning to see in some of our cities on the East Coast with controlled environment agriculture in all forms, hydroponics, aquaponics, vertical farming, all of this. We're going to need to be doing those kinds of things because we do not have enough land available quickly enough to grow the kind of food that's going to be necessary to feed our local population. So that's a little bit different answer from what you were looking for. But I think that we have to think on larger scale increasingly in order to meet the tsunami of this global food crisis that is headed our way.
But you're not suggesting that we try and persuade big companies like Monsanto to change their ways and let go of some of their profits. You're saying we should just go around them and produce something new. Am I right about that?
Yes, you are. I think one of the things that's become clear over the years is that it is not possible to change the direction of companies like Monsanto and Bayer and Syngenta. They are very committed to the way that they are going, and trying to affect change in that environment is a losing proposition. We're much better off building an alternative parallel food system from scratch. And that's exactly what's beginning to happen in many places all over the country. It's not very visible yet because it's still in the early stages. but people are organizing everywhere to begin not just increasing production of local food, but also beginning to cobble together the early stages of infrastructure that will be necessary to get that food into the hands of the people who need it. So that's an enormous economic shift. And meanwhile, companies like Monsanto, the Big Ag and Big Food, will oppose this direction. They will try to stop this from happening. And certainly we've been seeing that happen here in Boulder County in Colorado.
I'm Alex Smith with my guest, Colorado local food guru Michael Brownlee. He's just released a comprehensive new book, The Local Food Revolution. Well, lately, Michael, the United States has been in an election fever which is drowning out almost everything else. Is this food revolution a lefty thing, or can it cross party lines?
Well, I think it is currently outside of party line. I don't think that this is political in any way. We're having right now in our political system probably the most deeply embarrassing presidential election in American history. And in this time, which is, you know, maybe our darkest hour yet, we have an opportunity to ignite something that goes beyond politics, goes beyond economics, goes beyond policy. We have an opportunity to come together as a people to reclaim our food sovereignty, and I would say even our freedom and our dignity, by beginning locally, beginning with building localized food sheds. And I feel that this will be the source of our hope for the future. This will be our lifeboat as we plunge into the dark and stormy waters of the Anthropocene.
Well, yes, Michael, you've added a spiritual meaning to this local food revolution. I'm not sure that's necessary, but tell us why you do.
Well, spiritual is a funny word. People attribute various meanings to that. But what I would say is that we're learning that food turns out to be our fundamental connection with life itself. And part of what's happened in our society is that the industrialized food that we've been eating for the last 70 years or so has been disconnecting us from nature, disconnecting us from life. And when we reconnect with that, when we rediscover our connection with the land, with the cycles of the season, reconnect with those who are involved in producing food for people in their community, then we rediscover a sense of life and aliveness that for many of us may be only an ancient memory. But this is what is, I think, most profound about the local food revolution, is that this discovery of life at a deeper level is what's driving this.
Can you pass on a couple of success stories that have stuck with you?
Oh, gosh, yes. There's one up in Fort Collins area where a young couple who began farming about 7 years ago reached a point of success that they needed to expand their farm. They have a large CSA. They're doing very well, but they wanted to farm more land and wanted to buy land, but found it was impossible, that the land prices up there in that rural-urban interface were at about $30,000 an acre. And so they pulled together a meeting of their community and told them that the kind of farming that they were doing was going to disappear unless the community rallied around them. Long story short, what happened was the community did respond. They formed a nonprofit cooperative, and together they are purchasing a sizable piece of land there that they will lease back to that couple with a 30-year lease, and that will make it possible for that kind of agriculture to continue. And of course, that model is replicable. So there are now others who are, bringing their communities together to support local farming in this way. And access to land has been one of the big barriers to the growth of local food. That's Poudre Valley Community Farms, by the way. They can be found easily online. Another one is the Rocky Mountain Farmers Union here, which is an organization over 100 years old, has been helping to build infrastructure. So there have been a number of small food hubs beginning to emerge around the state, and they have brought 13 of these enterprises together to form a network of food hubs to distribute food from agricultural areas into the city, the state. So that's a very, very promising project because it is an indication of the building of real infrastructure that is essential as we move forward.
I'd like to finish off by giving a kickstart to listeners at two different stages of this process. In the first, we talked about the folks who feel landlocked and held prisoner by what they can buy at the supermarket. What are some of the first steps people can take to get out of that food jail?
That's a good question, and not an easy question. So one of the things that we would request is that people go to our new website, localfoodrevolution.net, and there they will find the Declaration for Local Food Independence. Read that, and if you feel aligned with the principles outlined there, please sign it. Join us in this revolution. I think that the first step for all of us is to become as educated as we can be about our current food system, what it's doing to us, and what this requires of us. You know, it's in a time of revolution, we are all asked to take a stand. You know, you can't be neutral in a revolution. We can't be bystanders because otherwise we are just complicit with the very difficult problems that are unfolding. So as I mentioned before, we have to make a commitment to withdraw from eating industrial food. It doesn't mean that we can do it immediately, but we make a commitment to move in that direction. And we have to make a commitment as communities, a real vow, a covenant, that we will localize our food supply to the greatest extent possible as quickly as possible. So, in other words, we have to quit being compliant consumers, and we have to stop being influenced by the power of marketing and propaganda by the Unholy Alliance.
Now, the second group of listeners are right with you, Michael. They're growing what they can. They plan to get more local food. But here's the problem. It takes years and years to make these big changes to the food system. How do we keep that hope fueled so we can keep on that road to real food health and security?
I think that is the very question that we are wrestling with right now. And I think the answer lies in coming together as a people. What does that look like? I don't think it means building new organizations or nonprofits or even new companies. I think it is convening community-wide conversations about these issues. You know, when we got clear here in Colorado about the impact of global warming on our food supply, we realized that there was no one in this entire region that was even discussing the possibility of building a plan for dealing with that. There is nowhere where you can go to discuss this. So we have to begin convening that kind of conversation wherever we live, even if it means only one or two people show up at the beginning. There has to be a place where people can go to begin grappling with the challenge that we are facing.
From Colorado, we've been speaking with Michael Brownlee. He's an experienced food activist. His latest book just out is The Local Food Revolution, How Humanity Will Feed Itself in Uncertain Times. And you can find out more at localfoodrevolution.net. Of course, I'll put extra links to the book and this topic in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays, at ecoshock.info. Michael, it's always good to talk with you. Come back sooner this time.
All right. Thank you very much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. Nobody needs to die in natural disasters. According to a new book, there is a science of prediction and risk management that can warn, prepare, and save millions of lives in the future. So why isn't it being applied now? We've reached an expert's expert as chief research officer for the company RMS Risk Management Solutions. Robert Muir Wood tracks global disasters. He travels into the crumbled or drowned chaos afterwards and models the risk. Robert Muir Wood was a lead author of the 2007 Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report and the 2011 IPCC Special Report on Extremes. Governments, insurance companies, and investors listen to him. Now we're going to listen, and I expect we'll hear strategies that haven't yet made it through the mainstream media. We'll talk to Robert Muir Wood about his latest book, The Cure for Catastrophe: How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Robert, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello.
Well, hi. Why don't we start at the ground level and work up? Why does the media fascination with epicenters mislead people about the real nature of earthquakes?
Okay, well, this is a detail, one could say, but it's a curious feature of history that a big earthquake is caused by the breakage of a very, very large fault. A fault is simply a discontinuity, a planar feature in the outer shell of the Earth. And the bigger the earthquake, the bigger the fault that breaks to cause it. And it's now possible to get seismologists to actually tell you the overall pattern, the overall geography of the fault that breaks to cause a big earthquake. I mean, when I say a big earthquake like the earthquake off Japan in 2011, that was a magnitude 9 earthquake. It was formed by a fault that was perhaps 500 kilometers long. But the media still ask seismologists to tell them where the epicenter is. And the epicenter is simply the point where that fault started to break. And that where the fault starts to break could be at one end or the other. It sometimes is in the middle, but it's not giving you a good picture of the totality of the fault that breaks. So it's a misleading element of how we communicate around earthquakes.
Well, we are at the detail level, and we will build up to the big picture, but I did notice that in an online video, you said Californians have completely underestimated the strength and number of possible earthquakes. Can you tell us about that?
Well, the situation in California, I mean, I think that there is appreciation that this is earthquake country. There's a plate boundary running through the state, but it's been quite a while now since there was a significant earthquake in the state. I mean, we have to go back to 1994 on the Northridge earthquake north of Los Angeles. Since that time, we've been in this extraordinary quiet period, and actually more and more people have moved to California in the past two decades who have had no experience of what a big earthquake is like. And sooner or later, somewhere, either in northern or southern California, there's going to be a big earthquake, a big high magnitude 6, low magnitude 7 size earthquake. And it's going to have very significant consequences, because while there is a very good building code today, there's a lot of legacy buildings which were built before that code, and we know a lot of those are not going to do so well. We can identify which those buildings are, but and we can try and retrofit some of them, but actually we can't get on top of the totality of the whole problem of what is going to happen in the next big earthquake there.
And the actual insurance in that region has dropped for earthquakes.
Yes, I mean, for homeowners, it's down to about 10% now, which is not good. It means that a lot of people, the day after the earthquake, are going to wake up to the fact that their house may be worth less than the value of the mortgage they have on it, and they may be tempted to hand it back to the bank at that point, and that'll have a cascade of consequences on the economy. We can see it's, although on some level there's very good science in California of understanding earthquakes, of the earthquake engineering too, it's actually not fully connected with how people the disaster culture in California is not anticipating what this is going to be like to a sufficient degree.
Well, good. Robert Muirwood, you've said risk management is a task of imagination. How did imagination fail in the great Japanese tsunami of 2011?
Well, it's a failure of the imagination. One feature of as we try and understand catastrophe risk is we need to have some understanding of how big a particular event can be. I mean, that could be how intense a hurricane could be, how deep a flood could be, or for earthquakes, just how big the magnitude of the earthquake could be, because how big the magnitude also tells us how big the tsunami that an earthquake can generate if it happens under the sea in a nearshore environment. And in Japan, in the build-up to 2011, the Japanese nuclear industry had sited 14 nuclear power plants along the Pacific coast of Japan precisely because they were assured that actually it didn't suffer the largest of all earthquakes, that they simply hadn't happened there. But in fact, some geologists and historians had discovered that there had already been a giant earthquake on this margin in the 800s, so more than 1,100 years ago, and there was increasing evidence of how big it actually had been. They took this evidence to the nuclear industry in about 2008 and 2009, but they couldn't really get people to take it seriously. And then the earthquake happened in 2011, which was pretty much a repeat of the event which had happened 1,100 years before. It was accompanied by a massive tsunami, bigger than the tsunami protection walls on the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants. And as we know, as a result, three of them suffered meltdown. And it was all highly avoidable if they had moved the generators higher up in the stations, which is estimated if it would have only cost $10,000 or something, they could have actually ensured there was a power supply to keep the circulation in those reactors going even after the tsunami had hit.
You know, when I lived in Vancouver, Canada, my children went to a very old brick school, and that city always knows the big one is coming, but it never seems to have the budget to make schools safe. If that happens in one of the wealthy cities of the world, what hope do kids have in northern Turkey, Chile, or any other earthquake zone?
Well, absolutely. I mean, it was a great innovation that came out of California after an earthquake in 1933 in Long Beach, where the earthquake had happened an hour after schools had closed for the day, and somebody estimated that up to 5,000 children could have died if the earthquake had occurred an hour earlier. And it actually prompted some very rapid action in California to ensure that actually schools were inspected, that first of all new schools and then old schools had to be brought up to standard so they didn't fall down in earthquakes. I mean, in California it was very successful, but they weren't able to export it effectively to other states and other countries in the way they should. And I'm not sure of the situation in Vancouver today, but I mean, there should absolutely be an inspection procedure for schools. We know what it takes. We know it doesn't cost that much, and it can really save hundreds or thousands of lives.
Very important lives. Let's move on to coastal flooding. It could be a high storm surge or a tsunami from a faraway quake. Robert Muirwood, if you had to list the top three most flood-endangered cities in the world, what would they be?
The most flood-endangered cities? There are coastlines which are very prone to storm surge flooding. I might include the city of Tampa Bay in Florida simply because, I mean, it has not experienced a big storm surge. It has a coastline which actually makes it prone to big storm surges. It requires a particular track of a hurricane to do that, but that hurricane hasn't actually happened for more than 100 years. But one day there will be a big storm surge into the city. In Bangladesh, we know we get very, very big storm surges from typhoons, cyclones actually coming into the Bay of Bengal, and they are a huge problem. They have built many evacuation centers now made out of concrete on stilts to give people somewhere to go, but that remains extremely flood-prone. I mean, another city which concerns me, again, is simply on my list because it probably doesn't appreciate the risk, is the city of Bangkok in Thailand, which knows it has a big river flooding problem, but also there's the possibility of getting a tropical cyclone tracking into the north of the Gulf of Siam and actually pushing a storm surge in front of it, in which case the city is only just above sea level and the whole city would be flooded as a result.
They did have some flooding a couple of years ago. I can't remember the exact cause, but I remember them. The factories were flooded and so on.
Yeah, they had flooding in 2011, in the fall of 2011 in Thailand. And I mean, the subtitle of my book is How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. And this was a classic case of a manufactured natural disaster in that the government had wanted to turbocharge the economy and by getting a lot of manufacturers who needed components from each other, for example, in the car-making business, to actually sit on the same industrial site. And in order to make this policy work, which they established in the 1990s, they needed very large areas of flat land, which was previously undeveloped and cheap, and on which to build these industrial estates. And I mean, that is another definition of a floodplain. So they used the floodplain, which had not previously been built on, of the Chao Phraya River to the north of Bangkok, and developed these vast industrial estates. And then, you know, you could not be surprised when a few years later they all flooded and remained flooded for 4 to 6 weeks, causing significant disruption to a number of technologies around the world, including hard drive and auto manufacturing.
That's why I remember it. My hard drive was threatened. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Muir Wood. He's traveled the world investigating and lecturing on the biggest disasters. In September, he released his new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. Well, Robert, as you know, Category 3 Hurricane Nicole recently blew through Bermuda, their second in October this year. What did the government of the Bahamas do that actually increased individual preparedness for storms?
The government of the Bahamas, in terms of actually what it has done around preparedness, I mean, certainly the Bahamas knows that it's absolutely in the front line of storms, and that everybody appreciates it. Much of it is very low-lying, so people appreciate they also have a storm surge as well as a wind hazard problem there. I mean, one story from Bahamas I tell as a sort of example of tough love is that, unlike the situation in the U.S., the government is not involved in providing a backstop if insurance isn't available, and there's what's called a canal estate, so a very, very low-lying estate of houses on the island of Grand Bahama, which is only just above sea level, which has been flooded in storm surges so often that you can no longer get insurance there. But actually, that's encouraged some owners to start building their houses on concrete stilts, and actually then by that means they bring them back into being insurable again. So there's a little parable about one way in which adaptation to climate change may actually work is that if the government is not involved, people will take their own action in order to increase their resilience.
There's a beautiful story in your book where during the 2004 mega flood of Thailand, the Japanese professor Toshitaka Katada devised a three-line instruction for children. It was like a tsunami haiku, I think, but I hear a value for all kinds of preparedness. I'd like to read those three lines, Robert, and then get your comment on each of them. It reads, "Don't believe in preconceived ideas. Do everything you can. Take the lead in evacuation." There's a lot packed in there. Why are these memorable steps so necessary?
Well, they're memorable steps in part because they were very successful, in that to this professor who had seen the way in which people had waited for official instruction after the great earthquake followed by a tsunami in the Indian Ocean in 2004. He'd seen from that actually he'd seen what hadn't worked, and so he came back to Japan, and he then promoted in schools in a single city his ideas for how they should distrust official information, how they should take the lead. And then two or three years after he'd given the lessons, the great earthquake happened off the coast of Japan, followed by a tsunami, and the students in the schools in the city actually really did, or enough of them followed his precepts. They didn't trust the official instruction, which was that a number of these towns had tsunami walls, and the tsunami walls weren't in fact high enough, and so they were quite right not to trust them. And they took their lead in actually running up the hill. They didn't wait for the teachers to tell them what to do, and all the other children started following them. And in fact, every child who was at school that day in this city survived, and even while more than 1,000 people in this particular city died. So This was very, very successful advice. You can't just assume that official instruction is going to have completely anticipated what is happening.
Definitely, and I think the people in New Orleans couldn't wait for the government to tell them what to do because it just didn't come.
That's correct, yeah.
So you've been in the inner circles of scientists and other experts on the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, yet it seems to me you've been wary of including climate risks in your portfolio, and you complained Lord Stern misused your research. Robert, are you cautious about the risks of climate change?
I take a scientific view of it, which is, I'm always a little worried when people jump to think about the risks of climate change before, first of all, thinking about the risks of the current state of the climate, because it's not that, we have a set of extreme events already, and then there's the question how they're changing. And there clearly is evidence that some of them are changing and will change even further into the future. But I'm a little cautious at simply labeling events climate change when we know that, I discuss in the book quite a lot about all the work that goes on in what is called attribution studies today, which is to run the Earth's climate with and without the increase in greenhouse gases back to 1950 and see what is the difference between a world which we have increased greenhouse gases and one which hadn't. In terms of if you run a climate model and you see how often you get particular events, for example, big floods in a particular part of the world, well, the original work in this area was done in big floods happening in the UK at this time of year, and see how what is the difference in the number of times that happens between these two worlds, between a climate change world and a non-climate change world. And that does actually tell you how the probability of some event has changed. And I think that is very, very helpful, actually getting this balance of making sure we don't get accused of mislabeling things when we don't have the evidence to identify the climate change signature, which we know is there in sea level rise, in more intense rainfall events, and, for example, in a longer wildfire season.
Another of my concerns is that a series of natural disasters close enough together could bankrupt major insurance companies, and with them, perhaps the banks, pension funds, and investors tied there. Could the system go broke?
It's very unlikely. I mean, it certainly could have gone broke, and it almost went broke about 25 years ago. But actually, I work in the area of risk modeling, and these risk models are now sort of very extensively used for how the insurance world does business around risk. And there's always some remote potential for a sequence of events to happen in some way, in an unusual way. But we can really calculate the probabilities of that. And actually, from everything I've seen, the industry is pretty robust these days. I mean, one feature, if we compare the banking sector and the insurance sector, and the banking sector had its crisis in 2007, 2008, where it discovered that the risk models they were using really were not at all reliable because they didn't capture human herd behavior. And actually, we find if we're modeling earthquakes or hurricanes, actually the physics of the Earth is a lot more stable than actually the contagion of human behavior that we may see in how markets behave in the banking sector.
Now, your book offers a cure for catastrophe, and that's a big idea, but please take as long as you like to give us some ideas of what should be done.
Okay. Well, I use the term the cure to catastrophe. I mean, I leave it ambiguous as to whether, is there a cure? Is there a simple cure? Is this like a slogan? Is it a hope? There is much we can do. There's much which has been done, which helps us anticipate and prepare for catastrophes. I mean, the first component is simply education. Is actually, we have a lot of good scientific knowledge of where catastrophes have the potential to occur now. Now, we're still sometimes surprised, but actually 9 times out of 10 or 19 times out of 20, we're not so surprised. The events that happened, we had really anticipated. So we can't simply blame the fact that, this was surprising in some way. And in which case, then we can plan and prepare for what is likely to happen. I mean, we know a range of earthquakes which can happen around San Francisco. We know the range of hurricanes that could impact different Caribbean islands. We have this information, and we should be focused on taking the action to ensure that, you know, the buildings are able to withstand that particular level of ground shaking or wind speed or flooding, and that people are prepared, that they are informed. The culture of disasters is sufficient to let them know that they are at risk and tell them what they need to do. And we can move to a situation. I mean, I mentioned a couple of places. I mentioned Holland around its treatment of flood risk. I mean, it really has got on top of it. It's owned by everyone. It's not just done by technocrats. It's sort of owned by the population. I think that Chile in earthquakes is getting closer and closer to the day when you can have a big earthquake and actually the casualties will be measured in tens of people rather than hundreds or thousands. So we can point at examples where countries or cultures are really getting on top of being able to ride out these events when they happen. And, you know, and it's not too far-fetched for there to be situations where we have a really big hurricane, a really big earthquake, and actually the consequences are fairly minimal. I mean, that won't be everywhere, but some places are moving towards that goal.
Well, we won't have time to cover much about volcanoes, which is in your book, but there haven't been many in the news lately. But that's another mistake, isn't it?
It's for volcanoes. I describe the great challenge of volcanoes. Big eruptions are rare. I mean, at a single volcano, big eruptions may happen hundreds of years apart, so that everybody who's given the job of managing the information around a volcanic eruption is likely to be a complete novice. I mean, it's likely to be the first time they have done it. And actually, the politicians will be watching this person intently, because there are many, many ways in which they can get it wrong. I mean, they can either get people to evacuate too early or too late, and they can get people to evacuate too near the volcano, and the volcanic eruption can be bigger than they anticipated, and they can get people to evacuate for too long, and so the economy can't start getting going again. So it's a huge challenge, the responsibility of being, if you like, the volcano eruption manager. And actually, we have not got a solution to that. I mean, it would be almost better if there was an international agency which was able to move in and provide this capability, but then that would be a problem with local politicians. So, yeah, I mean, we haven't seen a big eruption near a city since 1991 or something in Mount Pinatubo in the Philippines, and you know, sooner or later there will be another such threatening volcano, and the question is, are we prepared?
Well, we did run out of time before we got to fires, and that's ironic because half the countryside around me burned down last year. We had fire refugees arrive in our tiny village with absolutely nothing, so I'm personally familiar with that risk. Listeners, I've had time to read Robert Muir Wood's new book, The Cure for Catastrophe, How We Can Stop Manufacturing Natural Disasters. It wasn't a chore because this stuff fascinates me, and Robert does a great job of keeping us there in the scene while we learn from him. He's the Chief Research Officer for RMS Risk Management Solutions. He has a PhD in Earth Sciences from Cambridge University. He's been a lead author in two important reports by the IPCC, the author of 6 books, published over 150 scientific papers. He advises on high levels of business and government on large-scale disasters. I'll put links to Robert, his book, and some videos in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.info. Check it out. Robert, thank you so much for sharing your time with us. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock, and thank you for caring about our world. Here is a song I'm working on called Holy Nature, as in Holy Committed.
Yes, I say it. Holy nature, give us life. Holy nature, keep on track. Holy nature, can't take it back. In the rolling thunder, in the heavy rain, in the grasp of tides, in the restless heat, break the silence, break the calm. Rescue, rescue. days are days. Oh, Mother Nature starts our hearts. Holy Nature, never part. Holy Nature, never part.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast. In Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Hundreds of student activists are going to be converging in Fairfax, Virginia for the 2016 National Students for Justice in Palestine Conference. The theme will be Critical Mass with Our Roots in Resistance, Forging a Just Future. National SJP says in a statement, quote, our student Palestine solidarity movement is at a pivotal point. Confronted with forms of repression, both old and new, we must draw on our history of grassroots organizing to develop ways of effectively and proactively responding to this backlash while channeling our remarkable energy and focus towards our ultimate goal of liberation for Palestine and all oppressed peoples. Joining us to talk about why students are converging and what this pivotal point in student activism looks like are two members of National Students for Justice in Palestine, Samer Al-Saleh from UC Santa Cruz and Malcolm Lazzappi of Stanford University. Samer and Malcolm, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
So let's talk about the conference. Reading through some of the materials on nationalsjp.org, there's a lot of emphasis on, of course, building more divestment campaigns, but also pushing beyond divestment. Summer, can you talk about your work at UC Santa Cruz and what that means to you, especially since your university has already passed a student divestment resolution? What's next?
Yeah, so I think that a lot of UC Santa Cruz's RSJP is currently in a space that a lot of other SJPs, especially on the West Coast, are at, where we've passed divestment. And we're not quite sure where to go from there. I think that part of what we want to work on this year is kind of we're in a weird space where we're trying to figure out what is next. Part of what we want to do is to actually pressure the university to materially divest from the corporations that profit off of the occupation. But I think we also do want to move beyond BDS in the sense that we want to push forth on our campus more of an anti-Zionist politics where we aren't constantly having to push against or respond to Zionist organizations, but where we actually are sort of like have the ideological power on our campus where instead of us having to defend ourselves against university and the oppression, where we are able to instead kind of have a base of support, if that makes sense.
So as far as like what we're doing right now, we're doing a lot of education. We sort of fell to like deaf ears. Like, no one responded to our calls for divestment. We sent letters to the president, the board of directors. They were kind of responded with it's too divisive to talk about. So we're not even going to look into whether there are human rights abuses. So really, it looks like building power, like student to student, and like internal education. So we're holding like cultural events. We're like bringing in speakers, and we're really trying to build a base. Since divestment happened, like that was 2 years ago, and like a lot of people have graduated or are now moving into different parts of their lives. So we have to like build that up and then move forward. But you were asking about how NSJP is trying to like mobilize alongside and beyond divestment. Since we're like folks are hitting roadblocks at their schools, like what are ways that we're gonna try to combat this? And I think one of the most powerful things that this NSJP conference is gonna have for the first time is actually a non-conference space. You know, like each year we ask SJPs and SJP members, SJPers, what sort of like workshops they want to see, who they want to talk to, what sort of things they want discussed in panels, discussions, in presentations, what kind of skills they want to build. But at this conference, we're starting an unconference space, which is basically a space that, you know, people come together and they decide what they're going to talk about at the conference. And that way, I think it's really... like, I think we're bringing in an organic element that allows folks to speak specifically onto what they're struggling with, and then also speak with people who are specifically dealing with those things too. And I think that's really going to help with brainstorming and like moving beyond what we've currently been doing.
National SJP has said that students are now mobilizing, trying to strategize against what they call repression in forms both old and new. Can you talk a little bit about how students are mobilizing and especially what might be coming up at this conference, some maybe new strategies, new tactics that students are talking about?
Yeah. So when I think about like fighting repression on our campuses, particularly like the new forms of repression that exist. Like, I think this looks like building like across movements. So often what like the success of Zionist repression on our campuses, like from outside groups or from the administration, what it often looks like is like the isolation of our groups where we're stigmatized and like racialized and criminalized, and where they attempt to like set us apart and isolate us from like any other form struggles. And I think that what SJPs have been doing really well is like linking up with other struggles, like other people struggling on their campuses, as well as like not just on our campuses, but like also like, you know, SJPs doing stuff with the like Dakota Access Pipeline, like supporting what's going on there. And so I think often what fighting repression looks like is by kind of refusing this isolation that is constantly like forced onto us in a way. Given the political climate where we are like stigmatized on campuses, and like this, I think this sort of ranges, and it's like not something that we can just like apply to every campus. Like at UC Santa Cruz, I think it's a lot less extreme than it might be on other campuses. But like, despite whatever the level of like a stigmatization, it like often makes it really difficult for us to organize. And I think that, I don't know what we're thinking about, and I think what other SJPs are thinking about is like how to tactically think about sort of like shifting this political climate and taking advantage of sort of like shifting ways of then the ways that like Palestine has made its way into like mainstream discourse, and sort of like using that as a way to like push our own narrative to the forefront, where, like I said, like where we're not having to constantly legitimize or humanize ourselves, but where it's like almost a given, where it's common sense, and rather like the opposite side, like the people who are supporting like the genocide of Palestinians, like who are supporting the Israeli apartheid state, are like are the groups that are having to legitimize what they're saying, where we're not constantly put on blast and having to do that work. And I think that comes through. It's not an overnight thing that happens, like a process that will happen through like ongoing like political action and political education and whatnot.
Malcolm, why should students get involved in SJP and why is it a critical time right now to be an SJP member?
I think it's always been a critical time to be an SJP member, especially like there's SJPs everywhere, but especially in the U.S., given our government's sustained contribution to the Israeli state in, I forget what the actual name of the payment is, but we send billions of dollars every year. I think it's important to recognize that and be, and like joining SJP like is a way of saying, you know, actually we don't support this, but also building with like building outside of that framework of, oh, this is what our government does. And recognizing that we all have a level of complicity with regard to the like the nation state of Israel.
And Summer, finally, what are you most looking forward to at the national conference? What do you hope comes out of it?
I'm most looking forward to, I'm new to the national organization and I'm sort of becoming familiarized with the way it functions. Prior to like my involvement, I didn't really know like the work that NSJP did. So I guess like what I'm looking forward to is like continuing to build a structure within NSJP. So like last year there was, last year at the conference, they came up with a structure, which is like the representatives from each, from the West Coast, you know, South, East Coast and Midwest. I'm really looking forward to getting to sort of like sitting down with people and figuring out like what this means, what it means to have elected representatives in NSJP, and how we can like further build our structure so that we can effectively help other SJPs who are in different places politically, on their campuses.
I also wanted to add to Summer's excitement about building with the coordinating committee and this new national structure that we have that we approved in San Diego. I know folks have been saying this is a long time coming, and I think it'll yield itself to a particular type of national conversation that is, I wouldn't say just representative, but also more grassroots, because we're bringing in more people and we're specifically looking at each region and trying to bring like tie them in a very concrete way. So I think that'll yield to some very powerful stuff to look forward to.
Well, we are looking forward to seeing what comes out of the conference as well. And of course the work that SJP chapters and its members do on a daily basis across the country. So thank you so much for being with us. Those are the voices of Summer El Saleh from UC Santa Cruz and Malcolm Lazzappi of Stanford University. Summer and Malcolm, thank you so much. And
thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you, Noah.
That's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sue Udry of the Defending Dissent Foundation, who discusses some major concerns about government mass surveillance and the reform civil liberties groups will be advocating the next president and Congress adopt. Matt Wood of the media democracy group Free Press, who takes a critical look at the proposed merger between telecommunications giant AT&T and Time Warner. And Yale University dining hall worker Corey Menefee, who broke a stained glass window depicting slaves harvesting cotton, talks about the campaign to change the name of Yale's Calhoun College, named after a pro-slavery senator. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The Guardian newspaper reports a local government environmental official in the Brazilian Amazon, Luis Alberto Araujo, was shot and killed in his car in front of his family on October 13. The shooting of Araujo, the secretary for the environment on his city council, took place in the small town of Altamira in the eastern Amazon state of Pará. His murder was similar to well-known assassinations of rainforest protectors like Chico Mendes and Dorothy Strang. Since 2012, more than 150 environmental activists have been killed in Brazil, with studies showing the country accounts for half the global toll of such murders. Billy Kite, campaign leader at the NGO group Global Witness, observed that the killing of Luis Alberto Araujo marks a new low in the war waged against environmentalists in the Brazilian Amazon. He went on to say that the murder sends a message that no one is untouchable. Araujo's work, combating deforestation, had provoked a series of death threats. Federal officials had shut down a gold mine and broke up a deforestation ring that used slave labor to clear-cut 112 square miles of rainforest. Araujo also sought fines against the nearby Belo Monte hydroelectric dam for killing 16 tons of fish. Before the Citizens United Supreme Court ruling in 2010, multimillionaire Art Pope played a major behind-the-scenes role in the rightward drift of the North Carolina Republican Party. But once Republicans won a legislative majority in 2010, Pope has been in the driver's seat. Under Governor Pat McCrory, Pope briefly served as budget director and succeeded in implementing deep budget cuts in education and welfare programs. This spring, Pope's influence extended to the so-called bathroom bill, House Bill 2, that required transgendered people to use the bathroom of their biological birth. The law also banned any minimum wage increases or anti-discrimination statutes that local governments might adopt. Passed after the legalization of gay marriage, the bathroom bill provoked a serious backlash, with artists including Beyoncé and Bruce Springsteen canceling their in-state concerts. PayPal also abandoned plans to build an operations center in Charlotte. Pope's influence in the North Carolina state legislature can be seen in the passage of House Bill 589, which restricted ballot access in the swing state, cut back early voting, and eliminated same-day voter registration. The bill was passed only a week after the Supreme Court sharply gutted enforcement of the Voting Rights Act. The restrictions on voting rights, especially among African Americans, inspired the launch of the Interfaith Moral Monday movement led by Reverend William Barber, president of the North Carolina NAACP. This summer, a federal appeals court overturned key aspects of the HB 589 law, saying it purposely targeted African Americans, but early voting remains restricted in many counties. Once again, the Affordable Care Act, or Obamacare, appeared to be in trouble with the announcement that health premiums could spike 20% in the coming year. At the same time, there are signs of real progress, such as the 250,000 Louisiana citizens who signed up for Medicaid after the state expanded the program under Obamacare. Subsidies under Obamacare will protect most exchange enrollees from big premium hikes. Yet, plans on the state exchanges often don't offer the same benefits as those offered by employers, as insurers restrict consumers' choice of doctors and hospitals. According to the American Prospect magazine, in many ways, health plans on the ACA exchanges more closely resemble Medicaid designed for poor Americans than Medicare, which remains very popular with the American middle class. In most states, the debate over the Affordable Care Act remains frozen in time, and many Democrats are afraid to advocate for reforms to make Obamacare more competitive with other health plans. Many healthcare experts say that establishing a nonprofit public option is a key reform that would encourage competition within health exchanges and thus lower prices. The public option can make the exchanges more attractive to consumers, especially where private plans with broader networks are scarce. This is critical since big insurers like Aetna are dropping out of health exchanges. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
After former National Security Agency contractor Edward Snowden publicly revealed details about U.S. spy agencies' dragnet surveillance of Americans' communications, there was a push to enact reforms by both citizens and legislators. The USA Freedom Act, passed by Congress and signed into law by President Obama on June 2, 2015, mandates that telecommunications companies, not the government, will store phone metadata. The legislation also demands increased transparency from the Secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance, or FISA Court, which has been criticized as a rubber stamp in approving government access to personal phone data. Under the new law, FISA Court judges will be allowed to, but not required, to appoint a friend of the court to argue on behalf of privacy concerns. Despite these reforms and others that have been enacted, critics maintain that mass surveillance of Americans' communication continues under Section 702 of the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. A coalition of digital rights and civil liberties groups that have accused the NSA and FBI of using Section 702's internet program, codenamed PRISM, to surreptitiously surveil Americans, have called on Congress to let FISA Section 702 die when it expires on December 31, 2017. Your reporter spoke with Sue Udry, Executive Director of the Defending Dissent Foundation. Here, Udry discusses some of her group's ongoing concerns about government surveillance, privacy, and security that the next president will need to address. She'll also review the major party presidential candidates' positions on these issues and the reforms her group and other civil liberties activists will be advocating the next president and Congress to adopt.
So the agenda is long, but to focus particularly on surveillance, at the federal level, we've got the program that the NSA used to authorize their PRISM program, which was exposed by Ed Snowden. That's the kind of the internet surveillance program that is allowing the NSA to just scoop up vast amounts of traffic that goes over the internet. The statute that authorizes that program is set to sunset January of 2018, that section, it's called Section 702 of the FISA Amendments Act, which was passed back in 2008. We've got about a year to convince Congress that they should just let that sunset, and that's pretty unlikely, but it opens up the opportunity for us to talk about other needed reforms to surveillance with Congress and try to get them to pay attention to just the vast of the way the government at all levels is surveilling our lives. So just to run down real quick some of the things that have just come to light in the past couple of years, the FBI is creating a massive biometric database called Next Generation Identification, and they're gaining access to biometric data of, for example, they have agreements with many states to be able to scan our driver's license or state ID photos. They are collecting the photo IDs of every person who gets a visa into this country. They're looking at passport photos, and they're also being able to gather other biometric data like, well, obviously fingerprints, but also iris scans and all sorts of very sci-fi sort of bits of our body are going into this massive FBI database. So that's one huge thing at the federal level. And then across the states, we've seen police using stingray devices a lot more, automatic license plate readers, a huge, huge surge in surveillance cameras just on the streets. So every time you walk outside, you just don't know if you're being recorded by a state surveillance camera. So those are just a couple of the things that we're worried about over the course of the next year.
So what do we know about Hillary Clinton's views on surveillance and the many groups and individuals around the country that are looking for reform and additional checks and balances on the government's power to surveil their communications?
Sure. Well, Hillary has a record on this. We don't really, you know, Donald Trump, you know, who knows what he says and whether he, you know, believes what he says. But with Hillary, we actually have a voting record. So back in 2001, she did vote for the Patriot Act. And in general, she's not a hero on protecting our privacy, but she has done actually a couple of good things. In 2005, she voted against cutting off debate on whether or not to renew the Patriot Act Section 215. That's the section where the FBI is allowed to gather business records without a warrant, and that have been used to authorize the NSA's bulk collection. So she voted against cutting off debate, and then in 2008, she voted against the FISA Amendments Act, which is the bill that gave the NSA the broad authorities to scoop up internet communications, and that's also the bill that gave the telecoms legal immunity after we discovered about the huge amount of phone, how those telecoms were helping the FBI and NSA to spy on us. So she's done those good things. But then on the other hand, if you remember back in 2010, I think it was, when WikiLeaks did the huge State Department documents, it was revealed that in 2009, Clinton had personally ordered spying on UN diplomats, including Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, and trying to get her people to collect things such as his internet passwords and his DNA. So she's kind of creepy. She's got kind of, you know, she's done a couple of okay things on surveillance, but in general, her statements in the campaign have not led one to believe that she's going to do very much to rein in either NSA or FBI surveillance of, you know, via internet or phone.
That was Sue Udry, Executive Director of the Defending Dissent Foundation. For more perspectives and commentary on reforming NSA surveillance programs, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In the march toward ever greater concentration of media ownership in the U.S., telecommunications colossus AT&T announced on October 22nd that it reached a deal to buy media giant Time Warner for $85.4 billion. This proposed mega-merger comes after Comcast's buyout of NBC Universal for $30 billion, and Verizon Communications' purchase of Yahoo and the Huffington Post. AT&T is America's second-largest wireless carrier, a top broadband provider, and with its recent acquisition of DirecTV, a major pay TV company. Time Warner is one of the five leading U.S.-based media and entertainment corporations, which owns CNN, HBO, TNT, TBS, the Cartoon Network, Warner Brothers Studio, and much, much more. If the merger is approved, it would bring together one of the largest content distributors with a top content supplier. The deal will likely undergo scrutiny from regulators, including the Department of Justice, and possibly the Federal Communications Commission, if the merger involves the transfer of broadcast licenses. Many public interest groups have come out in opposition to the AT&T-Time Warner merger out of concern that consumers would be hit by stiff price hikes and a reduction in content choices. Your reporter spoke with Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group Free Press. Here he takes a critical look at the proposed AT&T-Time Warner merger and the positions of both major party presidential candidates, Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump.
I think it's important not to lose sight in all the dollars and cents and the very important economic issues of the media concentration this would engender. And when it comes to just the sheer size of the company, of the political power that this company would control, AT&T is already one of the biggest spenders on politics, both in terms of campaign contributions and lobbying dollars. So adding Time Warner would not only give them additional money to spend on that kind of stuff, but also give them a foothold in the movie business, Warner Brothers on down. And they have the DC Comics franchise, which, of course, is a pretty popular one these days. There's the media diversity and the control over what we all see and get to watch every day on TV screen and more online as well. There is the political consolidation, if you will, and the fact that AT&T is a huge lobbyist already for wireless and broadband issues and now would be basically making its bed with MPAA, the Hollywood lobby that is itself indeed very powerful already. And then you get back to the dollars and cents for people around the country who would have to be paying off all that debt and all this money that AT&T will shell out for Time Warner if the deal is approved. It's funny because this is what sometimes called a vertical merger. AT&T is not so much heavily into the content business today. And so buying a movie studio and a bunch of TV networks that are in essence AT&T's supplier when it comes to the programming they sell on their own cable and satellite TV packages. Sometimes those vertical mergers are dismissed, and for the last several decades they've been thought of as less dangerous than horizontal mergers, which is when you take out a competitor next to you in the same line of business. But we think vertical mergers are indeed dangerous, and luckily a few more antitrust academics and lawmakers are starting to come around to that theory. And what they do is they don't take out a current competitor for AT&T or Time Warner in any large way. But it gives a single company, if this kind of thing goes through, control over both halves of that distribution process. And so AT&T could use all the new content it owns against other providers of wireless and wired TV and internet service. I think Comcast and Verizon are pretty large and can take care of themselves, but also the smaller competitors like Sprint and T-Mobile, they can use this content they've acquired and try to drive up the prices of other providers' customers. You know, suddenly, not just Verizon and Comcast, but smaller competitors, smaller cable companies and phone companies around the country have to pay off one of their rivals in the form of AT&T if they want to get HBO or CNN content. And then AT&T can turn around and in that vertical relationship use the other half to its advantage as well against other content providers. They can say, we don't really need your stuff. We have our own, thanks. So they can play hardball when it comes to negotiating for content because they have so many hundreds of millions of wireless and wired communication services customers. So again, we think these vertical mergers are bad, and in fact, I don't know if you want to jump to this, but it's not just been groups like ours who thankfully have raised the alarm. Many senators and even the presidential candidates this late in the election took notice of this deal. That's how big it is. I can't believe I'm saying this, but with Donald Trump actually sounding a good note of caution and really alarm about this kind of media concentration and control of too much power in one company's hands. and then Tim Kaine and others on the Democratic side of the ticket also expressing concerns when this deal broke last week.
What do we know about Hillary Clinton's position in the past on these giant mergers and any position she's taken on this current proposed merger between AT&T and Time Warner?
Yeah, I don't know that she's spoken on it herself, but Tim Kaine was on the Sunday talk shows last week and said it was a major cause of concern. And it's funny because Hillary Clinton, I think, has more of a centrist and pro-business reputation than some Democrats do, certainly than Bernie Sanders, her main opponent in the primaries, did. But then you'll hear people talking about how the Bill Clinton antitrust enforcement under Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission was actually more stringent than the Obama administration has been. So again, we've kind of seen a reawakening of interest in antitrust, especially during what was a record year for mergers last year and rolling into this one. But we kind of hit rock bottom when it comes to stopping these deals during the second Bush administration and the earliest part of the Obama administration. And so what would a President Hillary Clinton do? I mean, that's to be determined. The campaign has been willing to voice concern about this deal, even here in these last crucial days before the election. And we hope that any antitrust enforcer worth their salt would take a hard look at this deal, and we hope stop it. But, you know, that we're kind of a long way from getting to that formal process right now.
That was Matt Wood, policy director with the media democracy group FreePress.net. Find links to more analysis and commentary on the proposed AT&T-Time Warner merger by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Last July, a Yale University dining hall worker smashed a window depicting slaves harvesting cotton in the residential college where he worked, declaring he was tired of seeing that extremely degrading image. The name of that residential college, Yale's equivalent of a dormitory, is Calhoun, named for John C. Calhoun, a U.S. senator from South Carolina and later vice president of the U.S., who was one of the South's strongest proponents of slavery and white supremacy. Calhoun was also a Yale graduate. Corey Menefee is the worker who broke the window. He was arrested and resigned from Yale under pressure. But with strident community support, charges were dropped, and he was rehired to work in a different dining hall. Yale students had been conducting a powerful effort the previous year to pressure the Yale administration to change the name of Calhoun College. Last April, Yale President Peter Salovey announced that the name would remain as a way, he said, of raising awareness and confronting the racist legacy of the school. Student and community efforts have continued under the slogan Change the Name, and on October 28th, the largest community-based demonstration to date took place as 200 people marched through downtown New Haven and ended on a plaza in front of Yale's president's office, where they attempted to deliver a letter to Salovey. When protesters were told he wasn't available, they vowed to return. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhu spoke with Corey Menefee, who attended the rally on his lunch break. Here he explains why he chose to break the window at Calhoun College and what he thinks should happen next.
Well, the window was brought to my attention maybe a week before. I had been working there about 6 months, but I never really paid it any attention, partially because I'm supposed to wear prescription glasses, and I don't wear them. So the window's kind of high, and it's dull. It's a dull window. I never really, like, paid attention to it, so it was pointed out to me by actually an alum, believe it or not. I don't know. It wasn't something that I was consciously planning on doing. It's just something that just sat uneasy with me, and over time, it evolved into my actions.
There was a lot of movement among students for some period of time to change the name of Calhoun College, and your action really jump-started a community response. There was a lot of support for you in court, and you did get reinstated. And now this rally, a few hundred people at it, marching around downtown and standing outside President Salovey's office, talking about the need to change the name. How does that feel to you?
It feels good. It feels great to know that others share my sentiment and the dislike, not only for the image I broke, but you know, the name John Calhoun dawning over a college. You know, that is such a contradiction, because John Calhoun wasn't about enlightening or uplifting anybody. He was about keeping people down and exploiting them. So that's why we're here. We want that name removed from the college.
What do you think about the people, and I know there are at least some African-Americans who I've read believe this, that we should not change, Yale should not change the name because it's sort of rewriting history, and that the fact that he was the person he was is a way of educating people about slavery and about white supremacy. What do you think about that argument?
I think that argument is weak. I think most people are hiding behind the fact that the man was a racist. That was his legacy, racism. Racism is not acceptable or tolerable in our society today. It has no place anywhere, you know. Every now and then you hear about a famous someone losing their job for saying racist comments or being filmed doing racist things, you know. So it's very intolerable and it's unacceptable. If you want to teach history, fine. There's no problem with teaching history in a classroom setting, but you don't want to hang that name as a banner over a college. I don't believe so.
Because the name itself, just by the fact that it's there, it's honoring that person, right?
Yeah, you're honoring someone whose legacy is literally putting others down, and there's no place for that in modern society. You know, those are primitive thoughts to enslave a group of people. Those are primitive thoughts. You know, we're in a modern era, and there's no place for that.
Yale has a committee. I guess, correct me if I'm wrong, I think it was after the incident with you where you broke the window and were arrested and all that, Yale set up a naming committee or a renaming committee to make rules about how to rename things on campus. And after they make their guidelines, then they're going to revisit Calhoun, I guess. What do you think about that approach?
Well, just what you said, we guess. Nothing's been confirmed by any office, any official office, that there will be a change. All we know is a committee was formed to decide what the guidelines and principles will be if or when they decide to rename anything. So that remains to be seen.
Corey Menefe, do you have any suggestions about what the name should be changed to?
Well, there are a lot of suggestions. You know, there are a lot of better names you can use. But James Hillhouse was a scholar. I believe he was a Yale grad right here in New Haven. Edward Boucher was the first African-American to earn a PhD right here on Yale University's campus. Those are just two examples. There are plenty of other positive names that you can use if you wanted to do that.
That was Corey Menefe, a Yale University dining hall worker who broke a window that celebrated slavery and boosted a campaign to change the name of Yale's Calhoun College. Find more news and commentary on the campaign to change the name of Calhoun College by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show, which is celebrating 25 years on the air in 2016. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine, and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
A non-privileged resolution calling upon Governor Wolf and the Pennsylvania State Legislature to ensure that individuals incarcerated and working in state prisons have access to clean water and proper health services.
Next week's final passes.
Pam Africa. Commenting on 160923.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'd like to thank Councilwoman Janie Blackwell and Cindy Bass for introducing this resolution. And I'd like to thank the power of the word, WURD 900, for helping to expose the injustices that's happening in the prison. And for over a year and a half, I've been investigating the water in the prisons. And, I've been given the runaround for a while. The water inside the prisons, and I'm speaking especially right now on Gaithersburg, which I had a copy of a newspaper article that talks about the dangers of the water that is causing cancer, destroying inmates' reproductive organs, and a whole list of things that's happening. And in Gaithersburg Prison, in order for inmates to drink clean water, they got to buy it. In Mahanoy Prison, come to find out that each prisoner is given 3 cups of water 3 times a day. The water is black and it's oily and it's causing dangerous skin diseases, and people are also dying from the water. In Frackville Prison, the water, each inmate is given 1 gallon of water a day. And all this is a war crime. Water is the necessity of life. On 2020, a few months ago, an inmate, and as it was coming in, and Mr. Wetzel was bringing him through, an inmate ran in front of the camera, and he said, an elder, he said, you got to help us. The water smells like goose poop and chlorine bleach. He said, we're dying in here. We're dying from the water. And our inmates in there who have got to wash and clean themselves, who have sores and things on them, and are suffering from this. They can't clean themselves, so they're getting heavily infected. I've also, it speaks about the diseases in the prison. And I want to especially talk about hepatitis C. Hepatitis C is a disease that affects the liver. And in order for you, the protocol for the prison is one that states that in order for you to get the hepatitis C cure, you would have to be bleeding from the vessels in your chest. You would have to be bleeding from the esophagus, or the majority of your liver would have to be calcified with cirrhosis of the liver. This is a horrible, torturesome disease that is happening. And from the statistics, because I do investigative work, it's up to 7,000 inmates who have active hepatitis C. In order for you to get the cure, you would have to be on a list. And the following description that I gave is where you would have to be. I'm concerned because I have a brother named Mumia Abu-Jamal in Mahanoy. I have a brother by the name of Eddie Africa. And in the other prisons, I have other inmates and all who have this, that is suffering under this. 10 seconds. Thank you, Councilwoman Blackwell, because you could, she's petitioning Governor Wolf to do something about that. Thank you for the power of the word, WURD 900, and long live John Africa for giving us the strength to stand before you and deliver.
Thank you so much for your testimony, ma'am. Mr. Decker, 160923.
A resolution calling upon Governor Wolf and the Pennsylvania State Legislature to ensure that individuals incarcerated and working in state prisons have access to clean water and proper health services.
And this here recognizes Councilwoman Blackwell.
Thank you, Mr. President. I move for the adoption of the resolution.
It's been moved and properly second. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, ayes have it. And resolution 160923 is adopted.
I've never seen an election like this, ever. The stakes are sky high, yes, but the options are bottom low, especially for black folks. None promise relief from the hell we inhabit in communities across America. And as ever, black folks hold the key. But to what? Certainly not our freedom. Mass incarceration is still a foreboding shadow over our lives. An incubus that sucks the lives out of millions, even after 8 years of the first black president. And cops are just wilding, a blue riot of arrogance, mayhem, and unfettered impunity. And they mostly remain as untouched as ever. Does anybody really, really now, we're all adults here, aren't we? Does anyone think any candidate has a clue as to how this problem can be alleviated? Have you really heard anything? Then choose your demon. Just know what you're actually choosing. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. Other human institution, the Black Panther Party's failures were as spectacular as its rise. The party as a whole never planned for the next generation, and many sisters were relieved of duty when they got pregnant. That's just stupid and a waste of personnel. For example, Fred Hampton's wife, a stalwart member, a very strong, dedicated member, well, she got pregnant. She had Fred's child. And she was, let's say, not ordered, but it was suggested that she not come back and not to bring the baby. It had nothing to do with her abilities, which were stellar. It had to do with the party's ability to take care of children. The late Safia Bukhari, for example, her daughter Wanda, was a toddler, a baby, two or three. She was at the Bronx office in New York, this child in a Black Panther office, not the greatest place. We really had the resources that we thought we needed, and we should have developed what the people in California really developed to a great degree, educational institutions and housing for the children of the party. That wasn't a national reality. The party also fell into traps because of hang-ups over race. Not whites, but black. Think of, for example, the US organization. The Black Panther Party should have planned more for the winter of discontent. All power to the people. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
How significant are the crimes of the Clinton Foundation? Could Hillary Clinton's presidential aspirations be in peril even if she does secure the presidency? What evidence is there that the Hillary Clinton campaign secured the Democratic nomination through election rigging? Could there be any substance to Donald Trump's claims of election fraud and media bias? And why are black Americans apparently drawn to the Clintons in spite of a record in power which has been hostile to that population? On this week's Global Research News Hour, recorded days before Americans head for the ballot box, we report on the election campaign with a special focus on the record of the nominee widely favored to win, Hillary Clinton. We'll speak with investor and writer Charles Ortel about his investigation into the Clinton Foundation's record of criminality. We'll check in with indie media commentator Debbie Lusignan, a.k.a. Sane Progressive, about the demonstrable election and media fraud she has tracked during both the Democratic nomination race and the race for president. And finally, we hear from Glenn Ford, executive editor of Black Agenda Report, about the Clinton family's appeal to and abuse of America's black population. On this week's program, Fraud and Corruption, Probing the Clinton Record. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 4th, 2016. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Moscow State University political science professor and co-chairman of the National Security Council of Russia, Sergei Markov, believes a decisive battle to liberate Aleppo looms, saying, quote, "I think that the Russian, Iranian, and Syrian foreign ministers discussed the issue during their recent meeting in Moscow. I believe that the operations to regain Aleppo will kick off on November 7th or 8th before Obama leaves power, and it will be a blow to the U.S. president by Vladimir Putin before his departure," unquote. An unnamed Western intelligence source believes Russia is, quote, "on the brink of a major military assault on Aleppo," unquote. If so, expect resumption of aerial operations suspended for 16 days, a November surprise, coinciding with American elections when U.S. public attention awaits their results. That comes from the article, "Is Putin Planning a November Surprise in Aleppo, Coinciding with U.S. Elections?" by Stephen Lendman, posted November 3rd. 20 years ago, the U.S. had the economic leverage to sustain the neoliberal policies of the Washington Consensus throughout Latin America. Today, the U.S. continues to pursue policies based on anachronistic power relations, seeming to ignore the fact that China is now a world power and a viable economic trade and investment alternative, successfully competing for markets and influence in Asia. Washington is failing to compete in that marketplace and, therefore, can no longer rely on docile client state. Washington cannot effectively control and direct large-scale capital flows to shore up its newly installed rightist regimes in Argentina and Brazil as they crumble under their own corruption and incompetence. Meanwhile, the world is watching a domestic U.S. economy mired in stagnation, with its own political elites torn by corruption and scandals at the highest level and staging the most bizarre presidential campaign in its history. That comes from the article, "Wall Street and the Pentagon: Premature Political and Military Ejaculations," by Professor James Petras, posted November 3rd. CETA is an agreement that reflects all that was negative about NAFTA. It provides the promise that further agreements, TTIP and TTP, will provide the same investor dispute mechanism that supersedes national sovereignty. It further disenfranchises the average citizen while enriching and empowering the corporate elite, again promising more for the future. It displays all the hollow rhetoric that is manipulated through the media, generally meaningless, undefined platitudes without context or reference to the realities of existing agreements. The Trudeau government is simply reinforcing the Harper government that preceded it, using essentially the same verbiage, but somehow with a kinder, gentler persona. That comes from the article, "The EU-Canada Comprehensive Economic and Trade Agreement, CETA, Backroom Ministrations and Secret Negotiations," by Jim Miles, posted November 3rd. JASTA, argued Theodore Karasik, would also permit Saudi citizens an avenue to sue the U.S. government and its employees in foreign courts. That would well accompany additional moves to amend domestic laws, quote, to allow their citizens to sue the U.S. government and its employees in foreign courts, most likely state security courts, unquote. Stephen I. Vladek of the University of Texas School of Law goes further in suggesting that the law will do little to bring home the litigious bounty for victims of 9/11 while enlarging the scope for U.S. plaintiffs to launch suits against states for international terrorism, whether Washington deems them sponsors of terrorism or otherwise. The punch against U.S. power, however, would come in the form of taking Washington's policies to task in very specific cases. Would, for instance, the Syrian regime be justified in suing the United States for its role in sponsoring Syrian rebel fighters who go on to commit acts of terrorism? That comes from the article, Suing Saudi Arabia for its alleged role in 9/11, Overturning Sovereign Immunity in U.S. Courts, by Dr. Binoy Kampmark, posted November 3rd. This week could well be remembered as South Africa's most important political inflection point since the September 2008 ousting of sitting President Thabo Mbeki by his own party, the African National Congress. His main tormentor then was Jacob Zuma, who, following a brief handover period, has ruled the country in an increasingly dubious manner since May 2009. But several contradictions have exploded in Zuma's face. Political opponents from across the spectrum, radical university students, and his own party's establishment smell the blood as Zuma's fabled patronage system is now in the spotlight, apparently in tatters. Zuma just suffered two major legal defeats, a fumbled state attack on Finance Minister Pravin Gordhan, which was humiliatingly withdrawn by an incompetent prosecutor on Monday following a national outcry, and Wednesday's release of the Public Protector's State of Capture report on the Zuma family's corrupt relationships, a report the president and two cabinet colleagues unsuccessfully attempt to quash. That comes from the article, South Africa's Deprivations and Depravations Revealed in Jacob Zuma's Meltdown, by Professor Patrick Bond, posted November 3rd. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. A pattern is clearly emerging of criminal activity within the Clinton campaign that cannot easily be dismissed with pivots to Russian hacking or Donald Trump's bullying and sexist behavior. This week, the Global Research News Hour investigates what is publicly known about the Clinton record. We start by looking at the Clinton Foundation and its odious activities. Charles Ortel has been scrutinizing the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation since February of 2015. His research reveals a pattern of massive fraud through questionable and illegal practices which has enriched the Clintons at the expense of the works the foundation was purportedly set up to perform. Charles Ortel is a former Wall Street banker, having been a managing director at Dillon Reed and Newport Value Partners and private financial investor. He'd received his BA from Yale and an MBA from Harvard Business School. In 2007, he became a whistleblower and was instrumental in bringing down General Electric after revealing GE's fraudulently overvaluing its stock by many billions of dollars to mislead its investors. He joins us now to discuss the foundation in the context of the presidential election race. Charles Ortel, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's my honor to be on your show.
Could you share with our listeners how this foundation was formed and how it came to be engaged with foreign countries and foreign policy initiatives?
Well, that's a great question. So under American law, there's not only general law pertaining to setting up charities and to setting up private foundations, but there's a statute that has to do with the setting up of presidential foundations. And those are meant, in fact, to be archives that house the records and, you know, the pictures and photos and now emails that a president will create during his tenure in a building where people can study those archives. And when you go back into the history of the Clinton Foundation, you see that it's very clear this was supposed to be a narrowly circumscribed foundation based in Little Rock, Arkansas, focused upon what Bill did during his presidency from 1993 to 2001. And what happened here is that as Bill exited the White House, there was a very controversial pardon where he pardoned Mark Rich and actually some other people, and that created a furor and led to congressional investigations. So the big money donors weren't interested in supporting this effort. Just at about the time that they began to break ground on building this vast complex. So what's come out now is that they needed to have a sexier set of objectives to attract the kind of big money that foundations get from governments, as you say, from wealthy foundations around the world. And there was this sloppy transition, sloppy in the sense that under our laws, U.S. laws are perhaps different than Canadian and other laws, you can't just solicit money and get authorized to be a presidential foundation, receive the equivalent of a driver's license, and then take that foundation to any other purpose you decide. The IRS is very strict. This foundation was supposed to focus on domestic matters in Little Rock, but by 2001-2, in the name of the foundation, people around Bill Clinton began to solicit money for a whole host of causes. And they basically have never gotten the paperwork right. Down here, we have over 1 million charities, of which this would be one. The IRS, our taxing authority, does not have the resources to regulate all these, nor do the individual states have the resources to regulate particularly a charity that might operate internationally. And so this thing started going all over the world, doing all sorts of things that it wasn't supposed to do, including mixing, as I think the WikiLeaks emails show, illegal private gain purposes, which are strictly prohibited, and as well, illegal political purposes. The staff of the foundation included people who were longtime political operatives for the Clintons, and I think we're going to find as time passes that the lines were blurred, that the Democrat Party, one of the key trustees of the Clinton Foundation was chairman of the Democratic Party, Terry McAuliffe, and a force behind the Clintons. The Democratic Party began to see this foundation as a way to raise money. And to now answer your question, in our country it is strictly forbidden for foreign governments to finance political campaigns. And where I think the Clinton Foundation has been doing its level best to obscure the degree to which foreign governments passed money into the foundation at crucial periods when either Hillary was running for Senate or running for re-election or when we had a big presidential campaign. Now, I would point out, I understand that there's a Canadian connection here. Your own Canadian government was a big funder, it seems, judging by recent revelations in the press and a book by Joe Connison. In the 2003-4-5 period, roughly, your government started giving substantial sums that were sent in the direction of the foundation, in theory, to fight HIV/AIDS around the world. Now, this foundation was never authorized to do that. They did not, indeed, have the controls required to do that effectively. And recent research in the last several months has shown without doubt that it's likely this foundation procured medicine that was adulterated, medicine provided by a drug company called Ranbaxy in India. This is a textbook case in how not to organize a charity, how not to operate a charity, and how not to defend a charity from engaging in illegal related party transactions that either create private gains for insiders, a crime called inurement, or allow the charity to be engaged illegally in political activities. This is a rogue charity operated in the name of a former president of the United States and an aspiring president of the United States.
Now, there's a particular, with the HIV initiative, there's a particularly egregious bit of business that happened, I think, over the course of 2008, in which there were funds that were taken that were intended for a fund program, and it ended up being overspent, but the Clintons ended up collecting that money, and then they were able to cover it up through through creation of an endowment.
That's a sordid tale, and I'm a little bit familiar. There's a law firm up in Canada called Blumberg, B-L-U-M-B-E-R-G, that is has a practice focusing on philanthropy, has written some excellent memos. your laws up in Canada are super strict, and the crime that you're just discussing, it's a multi-level crime. In the first instance, the entity that you're talking about, Clinton...
CHAI?
Clinton, I think it was... it was then called Clinton HIV-AIDS Initiative, right? That entity was illegally organized on March 24th, 2004. I don't think it had... There's no evidence, and the Clinton Foundation has provided no evidence that it was ever authorized. They claimed that they merged it back into the parent. That was impossible to do as a matter of law. They operated it, and then it was operated from a home base in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, but the Commonwealth of Massachusetts revoked its charter on March 31st, 2008. That's a matter of public record. You can see it for yourselves if you go to the Massachusetts online databases. And nonetheless, they, as you say, were soliciting money from governments, from the Gates Foundation, I think possibly from your government, and from people around the world. And as you say, they spent far more than they should have, and they diverted money away from intended programs. That right there is a series of crimes in Massachusetts, in the United States, around the world. The diversion of a restricted grant for an unauthorized purpose is a serious crime. And then to cover the record seems to show here, there are multiple different WikiLeaks cables and memos that seem to show that the reaction of the Clinton Foundation, instead of fessing up, was to say, why don't we cover this up by taking funds not out of an endowment, but it turns out there was something they were trying to call a quasi-endowment. Now, under U.S. law, there is no such thing. What this suggests is that monies were being directed towards the Clinton Foundation. They didn't land into the books. They were kept inside of a suspense account, and they took money out of this, what I would call a slush fund, and attempted to cover it up. Now, when you look in the books and records for this initiative for 2008, they're hidden on the Clinton Foundation site, the pages that would deal with this. But in New York, there's very strict rules. And the version of the, in quotes, audit that the Clinton Foundation submitted, it's not a legally compliant audit, but there's a schedule in the back that shows, ridiculously, that this entity's revenues were exactly equal to its costs, its assets were exactly equal to its liabilities in 2008. Now, in 2008, as we all remember, was a year of great turmoil around the world. This entity was operating all over the place. Currencies were rocketing up and down. Prices were rocketing up and down. There's no way in reality that the books and records would have matched off in that way, particularly given what you just talked about, the alleged diversion. And by the way, the memos that are out there claim that the CEO of this entity and the chairman of the entity confessed to the parent company that they had diverted this money. And then the memos claim, as Bill Clinton himself and others supposedly agreed, well, we'll patch this off. We'll cover it off by advancing monies we'd raised for another purpose. Now, when you raise money for an endowment in the United States of America, it is a strict rule that you must spend every penny that you raise only for that endowment. You can't take it in as an endowment, use it for some other purpose, and replace it later. But that's what they seem to have done. So that's a gross crime, confessed in these papers back and forth in 2008, yet covered up till just recently. And all the while, rather than fessing up and changing the books inside this country, in every state, in Canada, around the world, they filed false and mysteriously misleading reports around the world while they've been fundraising, using telephones, using the internet, using the mails. Down here, smaller versions of this, an $800,000 similar slush fund, has landed a sitting congressman, an African-American lady who's been in Congress for about 20-plus years, running for re-election this year. She faces 357 years in our federal prison for $800,000 in a much smaller, shorter-lived set of frauds, alleged frauds. This is a big scandal.
We're talking about activities that seem to break the laws of charity, and I guess maybe you could explain what mechanisms have made it possible for the Clintons to escape legal scrutiny here.
Well, in the first instance, this is relatively complex stuff, and former presidents of the United States are given deference, whether they deserve it or not, inside the country and around the world. People are, even I, when I got into this, thought, I know Bill Clinton and the Clintons have in some ways a sketchy reputation, but I mean, this is a highly visible celebrity charity. Lots of people are looking at this, or lots of regulators. So, you know, there's this natural, people are willing to suspend their cynicism and their disbelief and assume that, you know, that we're missing something and the books must be right. That's the first one. The second issue is that there never until now has been a case where a former president's wife has run for president, or spouse, I should say. So what one might argue the Clintons proved during their 8 years from 93 to 2001 is that they're bankable, that if you, you know, advance money to the Clintons, you might get many times that money back. So I think what happened here is that the people around the Clintons knew that Hillary would eventually run. And let's face it, around the world, I mean, in Canada, people are relatively straight. United States, actually, they were until recently relatively straight. But that's the exception in the global community. I mean, corruption is rampant around the world, and many, many leaders and prospective leaders are bankable. So money flowed towards the Clintons. And this thing has never had an audit, a legally compliant audit under our rules, even under your rules. It wouldn't pass. I mean, I'm not saying yours are any laxer. I'm just your rules, our rules. Any advanced economy's rules, this audit would never pass. And it's never really had an independent board. So it's never had controls. And then in our country, in the U.S., a lot of the regulatory apparatus, the names on the top of the door might be Democrat or Republican, but a lot of the worker bees inside all the regulatory agencies tend to be Democrats, as the story in the press demonstrated today, that 97% of the people who contributed in the Justice Department contributed to Hillary. So you've got a lot of people who are enthralled to the Clinton wing of the Democratic Party, and if they're not enthralled to them, they're also, on the other side, enthralled to the Bush wing of the Republican Party, which, you know, in this charity has, let's just say, overlooked obvious crimes and cooperated on numerous ventures with the Bush family and the Clinton family in this charity.
They had some significant involvement in Haiti after the earthquake. Could you maybe speak to how the Clinton Foundation altered as a result of that, and the impacts on the Haitian people?
Sure. So actually, the Clintons got involved with in the name of the foundation in 2003, and that was primarily to do this HIV/AIDS work without the requisite controls, without making sure that the medicines that went into Haiti were not, in fact, adulterated. So they started then. They may have dabbled in different economic development projects between then and 2008. In 2008, I think there was a series of hurricanes, and they got a little bit more involved in disaster relief in Haiti. Then in 2009, Bill was appointed special UN envoy to Haiti, and by January 12, 2010, there was the horrific earthquake. Bill immediately claims even now that he raised money for something called the Clinton Foundation Haiti Fund, and of course there is no such fund. In our country, you can't just say that you have a fund and not really organize it properly. It should be a legal entity, preferably a corporation. You need to file paperwork. And in particular, in our country, you can't get involved in international charitable work unless it's truly charitable. You can't support a foreign government doing work that the foreign government should do. You need to do stuff that really is charitable and really is scrutinized and really is performed by people who are good people with an unblemished track record. So Bill didn't do that. He just started raising money in the name of his own foundation illegally. He did not file the proper paperwork in New York State, where he was doing it from, or in anywhere else. And then they teamed up with the Bush family, and they created something called the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. And that's a small, relatively small enterprise. All in, it raised less than $100 million and spent less than $100 million. For some reason, that thing did claims, because it filed separately, that it has no foreign bank accounts. And of course, the Haitian currency is not the U.S. dollar or the Canadian dollar. It's its own currency. I don't understand for the life of me how it could have operated in Haiti. In addition, there's some major league discrepancies in the paperwork. The parent claims that it sent $37 million down to the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund. Sounds good, except that in the parent paperwork, they claim they sent it to a post office box in a state where the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund has never been organized, because it was always organized in Washington, D.C. That is a prima facie warning sign of fraud. The Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, for some strange reason, spent very little of the money that it received in 2010, less than 20% of what it received, which again makes no sense in that the people were most desperate then. Now, the big issue and the one that should raise the hackles of people around the world and in Canada and in the United States is that Bill got involved using personnel of the foundation and the Haiti Fund and others, the Clinton-Bush Haiti Fund, with something called the Interim Haiti Recovery Commission. Now, that thing solicited anywhere, no one really knows, between $6 billion and $14 billion. Bill was co-chairman of it. The former Prime Minister, Bill Reeve, was the other co-chairman. They refused to account for any of the money that they have raised, which, you know, for the life of me, I don't get. I don't understand why there is not a multilateral, oversight facility to oversee these international charities, because what ends up happening is the government of Canada thinks the government of the U.S. is regulating it. The government of Haiti doesn't really have an effective government. And this can be an excuse, and I think is an excuse, for billions of dollars to be raised and then get diverted. It seems that of the billions that they raised, money that intangible projects either went to a failed industrial park called Caracol or to a hotel project, neither of which were really in places that were damaged by the earthquake. So this is really, there are a lot of well-meaning people around the planet who would like to help one of the poorest countries in the Western Hemisphere and other poor countries. But again, this is a case study, it seems, of good intentions run amok with no regulation. On top of which, for a time, under Hillary's watch when she was Secretary of State, it seems the Haitian government decided to award a lucrative gold mining project to her brother. And this is just despicable. I don't care whether you're, apolitical, left-leaning, right-leaning. When people are flat on their backs, you don't put your boot on their necks and divert money from them.
What are the prospects that some kind of a legal mechanism could be brought forward either before or after Inauguration Day? Is an impeachment something that could be erected as a result of this fraudulent foundation work?
Absolutely. I actually would have a slightly different view. I think that if Hillary Clinton were to win, I think it's highly likely there would be a series of legal proceedings, not just in the U.S., but around the world. Were she to lose, an example will be made of this around the world. When you set up an international charity, and a charity in the U.S. operating internationally, you're vulnerable to all foreign laws. Our charities cannot break any law and still be a charity. So, were a country like Canada or France or China or Russia interested in making an example of this, you would bring this thing to justice very quickly.
Well, I think I'll have to leave it there, but I want to thank you very much for sharing these thoughts with our audience.
My great pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Charles Ortel, a former Wall Street banker who's been looking into the Clinton Foundation. You can find out more on his weekly blog exposing the Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea Clinton Foundation at charlesortel.com. You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. One rising social media star who has been doing her best to raise awareness of corruption within the Clinton campaign and within the media and political establishment generally, is Debbie Lusignan, otherwise known as Sane Progressive. She's been monitoring the campaign for the Democratic nomination and has chronicled numerous instances of election fraud directed against the Bernie Sanders campaign. I got a chance to reach Debbie by Skype and asked her about the more egregious instances of rigging of the Democratic Party caucuses.
In the caucuses, they would inform people They would tell Bernie Sanders supporters to leave before it was legitimate and their votes would be counted. Hillary Clinton's people and voters would leave and their votes would be counted. They were giving them wrong instructions. There was a lot of manipulation. We saw that in Iowa, and then it went on to Nevada, where we saw Harry Reid intervene. He had actually called casino bosses to let their employees go with paid days so that they could go and participate in the caucus. And we saw them streaming in. We have it on camera. They would go in to vote. They weren't even eligible voters to participate. So that was some of the things that happened with the caucus rigging. There was also, and I think one of the big red flags was electronic voting machines were being flipped. And how do we know this happened? Because this is not something you can see. Well, you look at the exit polls. And what we have with the exit polls is that they were not matching the official results. They did exit polls, I think 11. In 11 of the 26 primary states, the Democratic primary states where they did the exit polls, they did not match the official results outside of the margin of error. And that happened in double digits. And people are like, well, what's that a big deal? It's just a poll. It's a very big deal, because if we saw that happen in other countries, if the United States State Department saw that in other countries, and it's more than 2% a discrepancy between the official result and the exit poll, we won't consider those elections valid. But we had that happen in 11 of the 26 states where we did exit polls. And when this started to get traction in the news media, they canceled the last exit poll for California. So we had that happening. So it seemed like, and you know, also just common sense. Hillary Clinton was the front runner who couldn't fill a room. In California, we saw Bernie Sanders filling a stadium with tens of thousands of voters. At the same time, 2 weeks before, right before the California primary, when Bernie Sanders is having these tens of thousands of people in California, you are seeing Hillary Clinton. She can't fill a gymnasium. She has more people outside of the gymnasium protesting her, saying, "Drop out Hillary." Then she has supporters coming to see her. So if you look at this, we saw this all over the country. Hillary Clinton, there's a photo gallery on the election fraud blog website. She can't, there's hardly anybody seeing her. Bernie Sanders is generating stadiums, and the media blacked it out. They wouldn't show those. So that was another piece of evidence. And we saw one of the most troubling things we saw, and we picked this up early on, is that people were being purged off the rolls or having their registration changed. And the main states we saw this in were Florida. Arizona was one of the worst. New York was one of the worst. California was one of the worst. And when we saw in Arizona, we saw tens of thousands of people reporting that they had their registration either purged or it was flipped from Democrat, which they had registered for so they could participate in the primary, and it was flipped to Libertarian, Republican, lifelong Democrats were being flipped. So, and this happened in New York. We know in Bernie Sanders' city, hometown of Brooklyn, 100,000 people were purged off the rolls. Two of the election state directors in that state had to step down for investigation. Both the Republican and the Democrat, so that we know. I mean, there is mass and objective evidence to prove this. The media would not report on it.
What about mechanisms like going to the state's attorney generals? Was there any action in that regard, and what was the response?
What we found for trying to get remedy on this, I live in Massachusetts. Massachusetts is one of the states where the exit polls were not matching the official results in double digits. I knew there was something wrong here. I was screenshotting the vote. I was watching the vote come in, and I was watching very irregular vote changes when election night was going down. And we would see in some precincts Hillary Clinton having 100%. The 100% of the vote would be reporting in some precincts, and Hillary Clinton would have 100% of the vote, and there would be nothing for Bernie Sanders. Unfortunately, what we have seen, the Clintons have been affiliated with the Democratic power, and the people who are the Secretary of States were mainly aligned with Hillary Clinton and the Democratic Party. They were very partisan. They actually actively worked to make it very, very difficult. In Massachusetts, Bill Clinton shut down our polling places. He did four different polling places. He was campaigning inside of, which is illegal, because of his security brigade. Some of the people in these precincts, they were closed all day long and people couldn't vote. That was a form of voter suppression. And when we tried to get remedy for this, people brought a lawsuit for us. We were dismissed. We were mocked. It was collusion. It was collusion from a local, state, and national level.
What kind of response were you getting from the Bernie Sanders campaign?
Radio silence. I started covering this on my channel, and I was documenting it. I did it state to state to state. And so what would happen is I found is that we went through the election, we would I would rather have people contacting me because they had been trying to contact the Bernie Sanders campaign with very serious concerns. They had evidence. They had evidence of absentee ballot stuffing. They had information that they desperately wanted to get to the campaign. Nobody could get through to the campaign. I mean, nobody. So they would contact me thinking I might have an in because I talked about it so much, and I would call the campaign and I would try to call their lawyers. And people who were trying to get through to the campaign were desperately trying to contact me. They couldn't get through to the campaign. So the campaign was absolutely unreceptive to our concerns. I mean, I did everything. I wrote up a report to the Sanders that I had to send through their daughter-in-law back door. And that's how I eventually got some information. I never got a response from it. I had a petition with over 30,000 signatures, people desperately trying to get some answers of why Bernie Sanders wouldn't respond to this. I don't know if you saw my video in Philadelphia. I screamed to him outside of a Chili's, "Why didn't you address the election fraud, Senator Sanders?" As he walked by, he completely ignored me. And, you know, it's I have met some, you know, resistance with this because people love Bernie Sanders. But I'm sorry, he took $200 million from his supporters and he did not take basic action to protect the vote. And so, you know, I've tried to hold him to account to that. I still have never received any answers from his campaign.
Now we're hearing Donald Trump essentially casting doubt on whether or not to accept the results of the election in light of what you've just said. And for that matter, in light of what Hillary Clinton herself has said about supposed Russian interference in the election process, I'm wondering what kind of cognitive dissonance would allow Donald Trump or any other American to have complete faith in the election system.
It's really ludicrous and preposterous that the media is suggesting this. And, you know, it's really a trip to watch Hillary Clinton and her operatives go around, and they are purporting that foreign states, and they keep pointing to Russia, and I will tell you why that is such a load of, you know, crap in a minute. But they keep saying that our elections can be manipulated, that foreign state actors may interfere to rig the election results. And then they're saying, but our elections can't be rigged, so you can't look and challenge the results. Which is it? Either there is a real danger and that the results could be compromised, at which case both political candidates would want to make sure that they do everything to ensure an accurate accounting of the vote, or they can't be rigged. So it doesn't even make logical sense what they are saying themselves. But this isn't about logic. This is about manipulating the American people to go along with this is not an election. This is a coronation. This is an installation of a queen is what we're seeing in this country. And it's absolutely absolutely an outrage.
Yeah, you're mentioning about the media distortion of this whole situation. I mean, there are a couple of things that come to mind. The use of polls to suggest that Hillary Clinton's way out in front and Jill Stein is somehow not even a factor. Could you talk about a little bit about polling, the use of polls and other
Absolutely.
Little mechanisms that are...
Absolutely. What we've been seeing in most major media polls being purported in the American corporate media is that Hillary Clinton is leading and that she has these margins. But when you look at the polling frames, invariably, they are massively underrepresenting independent voters in these polls. Now, independent voters make up 43% of the registered voters in the United States. They make up a higher percentage than Republicans or Democrats. Yet a lot of these polls are polling independents at less than 18%. So that is absolutely that's a garbage polling frame right there. It puts the entire poll into question. And why would they under poll independents? Because Donald Trump leads in double digits with that group. So, you know, you can use polls to tell any story that you want if you know how to manipulate certain demographics. We saw it constantly with Bernie Sanders, where they were overweighting Hillary Clinton's top demographics, women, people over 50. They would really underrepresent millennials and independents when they were eligible to vote. And then they'd say, oh, my God, Hillary Clinton's winning. It's a game.
Yeah, it seems interesting that the Clinton campaign can seemingly getting a free ride talking about Russians hacking into the electoral system, but if somebody like yourself talks about the Clinton campaign doing an end run around Bernie Sanders or whatever, there's the term conspiracy theorist can come up.
I think there's something very serious people should be aware of. When we saw that the DNC, there was a leak, and we had the DNC emails from WikiLeaks, they were very quick to say that it was a hack and that it was by Russia. It's the same thing we saw with Iraq and the weapons of mass destruction. CIA intelligence officials who won't go on record with their name, who refuse to talk about the actual evidence, do not provide definitive proof, and it gets repeated as a fact. And it is being repeated as a fact. And what is very dangerous about this is where this is coming from and where these talking points originated. Most people don't know when these talking points originated. When the DNC emails came out and the content exposed collusion with the DNC and the corporate media to sabotage Bernie Sanders' campaign for the goal of installing Hillary Clinton into the Democratic Party nomination, they desperately tried to make it about a source that they invented rather than the content that showed it was them who were interfering with a fair election on the ground. And what is most disturbing is right after that came out, there is a group called the Aspen Security Group, the Department of Homeland Security. And they issued a statement stating that Russia was involved and that we needed to put our elections under critical infrastructure, our cybersecurity of our elections under critical infrastructure, which immediately sent up a red flag for me. If you look at the signatories of where these talking points came out that you see the media parroting for the next 2 months, it is a group headed by Michael Chertoff and Michael Hayden, people who were involved in the NSA illegal spying program. And at the same time, they're coming out with these talking points saying it's Russia, we have to transfer oversight of cybersecurity of the elections. We have James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, saying we don't know who did these leaks or if it was a hack, and we can't ascribe motive. But at the same time, this Department of Homeland Security group is coming out with the corporate media talking points, which became the narrative for the next 2 months. And they were seeking to put our elections under the jurisdiction of the Department of Homeland Security through the critical infrastructure clause, which is completely unconstitutional because according to the Constitution, only the states have the power to execute elections, and the Congress has the authority to change how elections are implemented. So it's really chilling. And they have moved forward. They did not move forward to claim full jurisdiction of it through the critical infrastructure clause, but they have solicited 18 states to work with them And they've created this election cybersecurity board, and the two co-chairs that they put on it, Alex Padilla of California and Brian Kemp of Georgia, are embroiled in election fraud lawsuits. So they're putting on the head of this cybersecurity over elections people who are embroiled in election fraud lawsuits and who have absolutely no experience with cybersecurity or encryption. It's really a red flag. We are going into one of those periods in American history that you always think of as historical, that, you know, this is like, you know, this was Cold War Russia. You know, this is communist China. This isn't how America is supposed to be. And we are understanding that our own government and our own leaders have turned against us. And it's going to take some time before the American people figure out how to respond to that. I tell my viewers, one of the ways that you can respond to that is do not give power to anyone who oppresses you, regardless of the letter after the politician's name.
Okay. Well, I think we're going to have to leave it at that. But Debbie Lusignan, I want to thank you for sharing these thoughts with us. And hopefully our listeners will tune into your YouTube channel at The Sane Progressive. And
Sane Progressive.
Sane Progressive.
On Twitter, Sane Progressive. Facebook, Sane Progressive.
Okay. As well as your site, electionfraud2016.wordpress.com.
That's right.
Thanks
thank
again.
Thank you.
And as you're fond of saying, stay sane and peace out.
Peace out.
In 1992, when Bill Clinton first ran for the Democratic Party's nomination for president, he reportedly secured 75% of the black vote in the all-important primary voting day known as Super Tuesday. And in the 2008 primaries, Hillary Clinton reportedly outpolled her rival for the Democratic Party's nomination, Barack Obama, until Obama started winning primaries. And in this past year's Democratic Party primaries, during the crucial Super Tuesday battle, where one in four primary voters were black, exit polls reported about 8 in 10 black votes went to Hillary Clinton over Bernie Sanders. Yet many have pointed to the Clinton presidency's record in the 90s as evidence that America's first black president, as author Toni Morrison called him, was actually hostile to the welfare of the African-American community, or at least those facing economic hardship. So what is the key to the Clintons' apparent popularity within black America? To address this question, we are joined once again by Glenn Ford. He is an outspoken commentator and executive editor of Black Agenda Report, an online resource detailing news and analysis from the black left. Thank you very much for joining us, Glenn Ford.
Thanks for the invitation.
Now, a bit of a fact check, if you will. What is the reality of how Clinton-era policies have impacted black Americans?
Well, it's been talked about a great deal that the Clinton regime hit the trifecta. It did away with welfare as we knew it and thereby mounted an assault on black families and especially children that has not let up since. It introduced so-called anti-crime measures that made Bill Clinton the greatest incarcerator of black people in U.S. history. And in the final year of his presidency, they set loose the banks, deregulating them, leading to the greatest meltdown of this capitalist system since 1929, and the greatest loss of black wealth ever since emancipation. So, yes, the Clinton White House has been quite inimical to black interests. But, you know, Bill Clinton started out that way. Those who say that he is hostile to black interests are perfectly right. And we have to understand where Bill Clinton comes from. He and Al Gore were founders of the Democratic Leadership Council. The Democratic Leadership Council began as an organization based among white Democratic leaders in the South, who in the 1980s were facing a real crisis because of the steady attrition of white voters from the Democratic Party, and in the face of Jesse Jackson's two runs for president in 84 and 88, campaigns that were really huge black voter registration drives, the Democratic Party was becoming, in many precincts, a majority black party. And so Democrats, white Democrats like Al Gore and Bill Clinton, had a problem in maintaining their leadership of a party that was becoming increasingly black. And so they called upon big money to help them out, to bankroll their new organization, the Democratic Leadership Council, which they promised capital would work towards the diminution of black power within the Democratic Party and the power of unions. The DLC then became the corporate bagman in the Democratic Party. And Bill Clinton became the first DLC president. So he started off with an agenda, widely advertised, and funding that derived from that agenda to diminish the influence of black people in the Democratic Party.
Hmm. How do you rationalize the active involvement of many black people in privileged positions supporting this, I guess, a backlash against that loss of white power within the party?
Well, I remember perfectly well when Bill Clinton became the champion in the eyes of some black people, and that was with Newt Gingrich's contract with America. This resurgence of white populist right-wing politics that was quite successful, and it seemed for a time that the barbarians were at the gate, and the only thing that stood between black folks and those barbarians was Bill Clinton. And that's how he developed this undeserved reputation as a defender of black folks. He parlayed that into a path that allowed him to destroy aid to families with dependent children, and then to introduce his omnibus crime bill. The assessment that he was the first black president was never shared by most black folks, but there was a general feeling that Bill Clinton stood between black folks and some white folks that were even more vicious.
Are the Clintons then effectively capitalizing on divisions within the black community?
Well, this is standard fare. He knows how to go to churches, and he taught his wife how to do the same, to appeal to those elements in the black community that want only that the white power structure recognize them and treat them politely. But there's a larger picture here that has to frame this entire situation, and that is the U.S. duopoly system. And in the U.S., the U.S. duopoly system is a double trap for black people. That is, when you only have two parties and both of them are controlled by the business classes, certainly it's a trap for everybody. But in the United States, in which a nation in which race is always central to politics, there has always been a white man's party. And this goes back to even before emancipation. And by a white man's party, I mean a party whose organizing principle is white supremacy. The Democrats were that party for most of the nation's life. And then after 64, really, not 68, the Republican Party became the white man's party. And so if you always have a white man's party, the duopoly system dictates that there's only one party for the black folks to be in, and that's the one whose organizing principle is not white supremacy. It doesn't mean that it's a black-friendly party, but it's not the party that is that organizes on the basis of white supremacy. So blacks are locked into this Democratic Party. And They therefore make decisions about who to support in the Democratic primaries based upon who they perceive will be the strongest candidate to defeat the white man's party. That is the main goal of participating in politics. And the strongest candidate, that is, the candidate that people perceive as being the strongest, is almost always the one with the most money, that is, the corporate candidate. So we see that in primary elections, black folks tend to support the more conservative candidate, the more corporate candidate, the richest candidate, in hopes that they'll beat the white man's party. Candidates that do not reflect the black political consensus, which is far to the left of the Democratic Party's center, but is a defensive mechanism to beat back the most reactionary party, the most racist party, the Republicans at the moment.
I see. Well, in that instance, I mean, I want to note that beyond the duopoly, there's been a lot of endorsements of Jill Stein and Ajamu Baraka of the Green Party on your site. I'm wondering what, in your opinion, are realistic and actionable options available to the American public seeking justice and amelioration of the conditions affecting economically and racially marginalized Americans. I mean, you know, elections at the congressional level, civil disobedience. You know, what are your thoughts about that?
Well, movement politics are, of course, the most important, and especially for black folks. Historically, that's been the case. And we've seen extraordinary, wonderful developments on the social movement front in terms of this emerging black-led movement that people describe as the umbrella term. And we've seen that black millennials are not wedded to the Democratic Party as their mothers and fathers and uncles and aunts are. And their ambivalence about the Democrats is what has Hillary Clinton's people most worried, if they have any worries at all about this election. That is the lack of enthusiasm among young black folks for the Democratic Party. That has not translated in huge numbers for the Green Party because black folks have no more access to information about the Green Party than white people, and in fact, probably a lot less. The blackout of the Greens is in some arenas almost total. But black folks do, especially young folks, want alternative electoral choices as well as showing a real enthusiasm for social movements.
Glenn, I'm afraid we're out of time, but I want to thank you for appearing on the show and sharing your insights with us.
Well, thank you.
We've been speaking with Glenn Ford, who's based a writer and a broadcaster and executive editor of the Black Agenda Report. And he joins us from New Jersey. You can read more of his commentaries on the site blackagendareport.com.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.